Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of the Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
There's nothing on earth like a genuine, bona fide, electrified six-car monorail. What I say?
Monorail.
What's it called?
Monorail.
That's right, monorail.
Monorail.
I hear those things are awfully loud.
It glides as softly as a cloud.
Is there a chance the track could bend?
Not on your life, my Hindu friend.
What about us brain dead slobs?
You'll be given cushy jobs.
Were you sent here by the devil?
No good, sir, I'm on the level.
The ring came off my pudding can.
Take my penknife, my good man. I swear it's Springfield's only choice. Throw up your hands and raise your voice.
Monorail.
What's it called?
Monorail.
Once again.
Sorry, Mom, the mob has spoken.
Mono!
Don't!
When the weight of the world has got you down and you wanna end your life, bills to pay, a dead-end job, and problems with a wife. But don't throw in the towel, cause there's a place right down the block where you can drink your misery away. At Flames,
let's all go to Flames.
When liquor in a mug can warm you like a hug, and happiness is just a flaming mow away. Happiness is just a flaming mow away.
Party!
Was tut sich in der weiten Welt, Mr. Gumbel?
It is 29 minutes after the hour of 1, and this is the month of March in the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, America's new best friend and home of whimsy. Thank you for joining us. It is Friday, and welcome to day 12. It is Friday, March 4th, 2011. If you would like to join us today with your comments, questions, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings, obfuscations, rhymes, wriggly-piggledy, rat-a-tat-tat, whatever it is you might have, it's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. Let me understand this just before we get any further into the show, before I wade hip-deep into today's broadcast on. First of all, I got one of those things where I bit the inside of my mouth this morning.
That sucks.
I try not to eat, breakfast, because I eat breakfast. If I eat, I get the, in the morning, I get the carb fatigue. Not even carb fatigue, just I think food fatigue. You know, it's like you eat, and then you got a little siesta that you crave, almost.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It's not like I can't eat ever. I'm just saying, like, if I eat in the morning, because I'm not a morning person, I can sort of fake it, and I can train myself to be a morning person. You know, it's like I was up and around and doing something, and then I ate something, and it's like I tried not to eat that much, because then, again, you just go home and... Also, because let me just go do a thing inside a thing. You have a dog and you have a cat. Do you have just the two? One dog or the two?
One dog.
One dog, one cat. So do you do this when you get ready to leave the house? Is it impossible to leave sometimes when you just look over and you see the dog and the cat just going, and it just makes it so difficult to walk out into the cold ass gray world when the dogs are like, that's great. Well, you just make sure the blinds are closed too. I'm gonna go. And they're just, you know, and they're all curled up and just looking all snug and cozy. And you're like, oh, God damn it, why do I have to leave?
The cat particularly, the cat stays in bed, and then I go back into the bedroom to get something out of the bedroom. And the cat just, like, is snuggled down into the covers and looks up over her shoulder at me like, really, what? I'm sleeping.
Man, I'm sleep
either, in or out, because...
So I was out this morning, then I went back home, and it's like the dogs are there, just dead to the world, just completely wrapped in swaddling clothes, like little hairy Christs on the couch, just sleeping the day away, which means it's already difficult for me to drag my American ass back off the couch and then leave, you know, come here, so I can sit some more. Because I really put in the hard work for everybody.
You do.
Your
brain works hard.
It's
hard brain work.
It needs all the calories it can get. So then I was eating breakfast this morning, and then I didn't think of biting the inside of my mouth. And so, of course, I have bitten it 75 more times since then. And it just becomes this Sisyphean thing that is never just, I mean, it's some sort of a horrible Mobius pain that just goes on and on.
Well, once you get that little protrusion after biting the first time, then it's there, and then it's in the way of your teeth.
Right.
And you keep biting it.
It swells.
And it's so horrible. And you get, okay, I got to stop doing that. I can't do that again. But then, of course, you're not thinking about it.
Right.
And then you're just chewing something. Ah, damn it, I did it again. It's horrible.
Because chewing is effectively an autonomic function. You don't really you don't chew deliberately. It's not like a premeditated action that you're masticulating there. You just kind of go. And then you bite it again. And so the only solution is to either just be really careful about it, or wait the 3 weeks that it's going to take to heal, or that thing of just like having like a liquid diet like they made me do when I bit through my tongue when I was a kid. So, anyway.
Sorry that happened to you.
This morning or when I was a kid?
Both.
Yeah. Boy, you know what? Let me just tell you this. Biting your tongue when you're a kid and biting like clean through it as I did, that's nothing you want to do. Well, and it didn't bite it off, but it was the thing. I guess I should clarify. It's not that I bit clean through it as such, but I bit deeply into it on both the top and the bottom. Because when I was a kid, less so now, but when I was a kid, my front teeth, what are these, like your buck teeth? But what are these actually called? These aren't your canines. These are incisors?
I don't know what the two front teeth are called.
But the front teeth, but they were...
Yeah, your incisors are like these on the side there.
Your teeth fall out when you're a kid and they come back in, but they come at different times. So at one point I was missing a couple teeth in the front, and I just had this one, which meant it was basically like a drill press. And so I was out playing at recess, laughing and enjoying God's creation. And then some other kid came up and we were like, you know, roughhousing, horsing around. And I got knocked over and just went kunk. And just bit deeply into my tongue.
Oh.
And, of course, that top tooth, which it was sort of standing alone, like the cheese, just sort of went right down. And then on the bottom, it was the same thing. So it was just perforating it.
Why are you telling me this story?
Here's the great thing about it is it's sort of like what we were saying the other day about we wish we could turn back the camera of lifetime sometimes to see how things worked in the past if we can't remember it.
If, like Cher, we could turn back time.
Exactly. What you'd see is me walking slowly because every step just hurt like an infernal cauldron of punishment inside my mouth. Me walking very slowly to the nurse's office, just going and afraid to put my tongue back into my mouth because that would require moving it and like maybe brushing it with my lips or my teeth again. So just leaving my tongue hanging out like some sort of overexcited canine going, ah, and just sort of walking to the nurse's office. I'm pretty sure I was, like, dripping blood the entire way, which is sort of awesome when you're an 8-year-old boy or however old I was. I mean, it hurt and it was horrible, but I will tell you this, and this tells you everything you need to know about me. As I was walking from the playground to the nurse's office, where they then, I think they called my mom or whatever they did, but I walked into the nurse's office, I did have the presence of mind on the way. When I was walking by several girls, and they said, "What's wrong?" And I turned and I went, "Ah!" Big mouthful of blood.
And they screamed
it was awesome.
Little girls, which
totally.
They were.
It was completely worth it, almost. Except that was the night we had pork chops at home. There were no pork chops for Rick.
Oh.
I literally had like, you know what I had like.
You don't want to damage your tongue on pork chops.
No,
night.
I couldn't have anything salty. I couldn't have anything.
Oh.
You know what I had? I swear to God, I had creamed potatoes for like the next 3 days.
Oh, God.
It sucked. My sister, these pork chops sure are good. You wish you could have some. Anyway.
Sisters.
Oh, because I bit my mouth this morning, so we're talking about that. But I just wanted to clarify before we went into the program here. So you consumed some sort of large cask of energy drink this morning. Mm-hmm. And now and that's not even gone, and yet you have pre-armed yourself with a full can of Vizo.
It's been a long morning. I had to get up very, very early this morning. To stalk Michael Ian Black, because he was... originally, he was going to be in here for Greg and Sarah to interview him at 10:15. And the thing is, of course, we begin our processes around 11:30 or so, go on the air at noon. So I realized if I was going to get all of my news gleaning and everything done, my best idea was just to get in here as early as possible. So, yeah, I got up. I had, like, coffee. Came in here, and I realized I need more. So I started drinking this huge energy drink. And lucky for me, too, because I got in here, I think I was here at, like, 8:30. And Sarah and Greg come running in a little after 9, and they're going, did you get our message? And I was like, no. He said, he's coming an hour early.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, okay. So lucky for me.
But you were prepared.
But yeah, so, but that's been the thing. It's like, it's now 2 o'clock, and I've just been going, you know.
Nonstop
since like 7:30, 8 o'clock this morning. And I need all of the... all of the chemical help I possibly can.
Now, were you did you come in early, A, because you wanted to get prepared for Legion of News or for this show, but also because you wanted to be awake and caffeinated so that you were at your witty and funny and charming best?
It was really about getting my work done, because I didn't really talk to him much. I introduced myself. I told him I listened to his podcast, and he seemed very flattered, you know, that I listened to the podcast. He made a lot of really sexy eye contact, and we shook hands a couple of times, and it was awesome. But really, I was not.
Does he know it was sexy eye contact, or is that like a one-way equation?
I think it was just in my head.
Okay.
But but the thing is, it's like I made a little bit of a fool of myself in front of Sarah. Because Sarah had asked me yesterday, it's like, you know, Michael Ian Black's coming in. Oh, do you want to sit in? And I said, do I? So I get here this morning. It's like, oh, Don, do you want to come in? I'm like, sure. So I come on in. And I grab my headphones. I'm like, where do you want me? And Sarah's kind of like, oh, ooh. We want you over there against the wall. And I was like, oh, by sit in, you mean actually just be in the room.
In the back of the room, speaking to no one. That's where we'd like you to be.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, okay. And I pretended that I was just like, la, 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 and did not feel like a colossal ass. And then she pretended that I was not a colossal ass, and nothing was spoken of it again.
Well done.
And I just like put the headphones back really quick and then took my seat and then continued on as if nothing had happened.
I'll just sit here and stare at my shoes.
But and he was very funny, and I guess that'll be up later today, Fun Employment Radio. And it really is a very fun little interview they did with him, during which, I won't give it away why, so it'll give you a... But Michael Ian Black actually called Sarah a semantic bitch.
Really?
Yes.
Awesome.
They now, got off on this whole conversation that I guess they have had many times about when and how you can feed mogwais.
Yeah.
And so they asked Michael Ian Black about that, and He schooled them. He basically put them in their place, basically.
Well, you mean that he had the definitive answer about it?
Yes,
we were arguing about that the other day.
Yeah, he said, well, come on. Of course, it's whatever time zone you are in is
midnight
until dawn, which is when the sun comes up.
Well, so he claims. Here's the thing. Is that Sarah and Greg and I were having a big argument about that the other day. That apparently comes up a lot because I thought it was just like maybe a one-off thing. Like maybe it was just... So I walked by the studio. I know it was like maybe last week or something, and I was like going from the restroom to the downstairs or the kitchen, whatever, and they're like, I walk by and the door's open, and Greg says, hey, you have a second? And I said, yeah. And he goes, mogwais, you can't feed them after midnight, right? And I said, well, and I just left it on that sort of elliptical end, and Sarah said, see, I told you. And clearly, just like my sort of non-answer indicated that it was not the hard and fast rule that Greg, because I said, well, for example, what if you feed your mogwai? He's got like, just a little tiny particle of food stuck between his teeth. That slips down his throat somewhere after midnight. Has he eaten after midnight? Or is the eating the actual chewing and intending to swallow? What if it gets stuck in his tooth, swallows, and how much food? Mm. Are we talking just like little tooth scum?
Yeah.
Are we talking like it's got to be a mouthful?
If you feed him like 15 minutes before midnight and he's still digesting?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then it was the thing of like, well, you know, where on the international dateline you got to be, and does daylight savings time come into play, or is it about the sun coming up, and when is the sun considered to be up?
Well, Michael Ian Black believed it is definitely midnight, whatever time zone you are in, and that dawn qualifies as the sun has come up. Yeah. So... we'll see. But anyway, it was a lot of fun.
Was
and,
he a pretty man in person?
He's a nice looking man. He's a good looking, well groomed gentleman.
Maybe pretty is the wrong way to put it. But he's an attractive guy.
Yeah.
A youthful, attractive young sprite.
He's another one of those guys though that he's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 feet tall, which I don't tend to think of as being big.
Right.
Because.
Well, Patrick's a tall guy.
Patrick's tall, and I know a lot of guys that are 6 foot-ish, but the thing is that a lot of actors are very, very small, so you see him in movies and on television, and he always looks very tall. He always seems like he's the big gangly guy who's
right.
towering over everyone, and he's really not that enormously tall. He's not Ben Bailey tall, But no, he was very, very nice and very personable and very, very relaxed and charming and funny. And I think it was a very entertaining interview.
Now, is he performing? Is he doing a gig or something here?
Yeah,
he must be.
He's doing. He's doing. He's going to be doing a special. His first ever like actual solo comedy special. They're going to be filming it like in a few weeks in Philadelphia. And so I think what he's doing is he's traveling around and working up material and practicing.
Yeah, so he's doing the sort of, he's workshopping it.
Yeah, so he's doing, so like he said, so if you want to see a couple of rehearsals for a comedy show, come on down. But yeah, he's going to be at Helium. He's doing like two shows tonight, I believe.
Awesome.
And then he also has a movie coming out today. He's in that Take Me Home Tonight movie, which is sort of like they mentioned that. And he was like, well, yes, I have a very tiny part. And he also said that would be count as a cameo if he was famous enough, you know, for it to be. But really, it's just I have a very small part. And then Greg, trying to be helpful, I think either Greg or Sarah goes, well, you're listed 10th on IMDb. And he goes, oh, yes, because that's important. 10th. 10th is important. Name 10 characters in any movie. Name 10 actors in The Godfather. I dare you. Yes. Yes, I'm listed 10th.
That's awkward.
So that was kind of fun. Yeah, the whole interview was very awkward, but very, very funny.
Here's the thing about this Take Me Home Tonight movie. I'm looking at the soundtrack right now because here's the thing. You had mentioned the other day that it seemed like you were constantly seeing the ad for it, and then it would put the Eddie Money song of the same name in your head, the titular song.
And then Sarah was doing that today because she was going to be interviewing him, and she saw that the movie was coming out. So the whole time we're waiting for him to show up, she's sitting here, and every once in a while she'll just go, take me home tonight. I'm like, shut up.
And so that just gets stuck in your head every time.
God.
Now, I have successfully avoided the, I mean, I'm sure it's amusing and all, but I have successfully avoided seeing the trailer. I haven't seen it. I don't know anything about it. Did you say, is it like a coming of age thing?
I haven't seen the full trailer. I've just seen the commercial on TV, and it's like Tough Grace, a bunch of guys in a car, woo, party, road trip, something explodes, hey, pretty girl, we're in trouble. And that's really just what it looks like. It looks like it's
does
kind
it take
of,
place in the 80s?
It looks like it ought to be an homage to 80s wacky coming of age One Wild Night comedies.
The thing is, just to One Wild Night, the thing is, just to screw with you, I almost played that song during the little break here between Legion of News and this show, because I'm looking at the soundtrack. The soundtrack to Take Me Home Tonight. First of all, I mean, we live in the weirdest time. I mean, we live in the strangest. Before I even say this, we should just say, coming up today, we got your Taser Watch, Penis Watch coming up, Clergy Watch. Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the studio with another installment of Humor Meet Comedy 101 today, talking about the life, work, art, and legacy of Mr. Bob Newhart. We've also got clue number 5 in the E.H. Vending Name That Snack Contest. I may get to this goddamn just millstone of a top 5, which I am now just dragging around behind me. There's like so many Marley-esque chains. So we'll try to get to that and so forth. Plus, we'll talk about Sleep Country. Because here's the thing. So we got a listener, Jenny, and many of the other fine assembled. Jenny and her band of merrymakers have put together again the... is it the Rick Emerson Sleep Country team or is it the Emerson News Network Sleep Country team? What is the official name of it?
I don't know.
I think it's the Emerson News Network Sleep Country team for the Sleep Country Pajama Bowl. Here's why everybody has to start giving them money. Right now, they're beating most of the radio stations. I mean, which is not like, I mean, let's be honest, not like radio stations know anything about making or saving money at this point. So they're beating most of the radio stations. What I did not know, and Jenny's going to be in the studio next Tuesday to talk about this, I did not know that Aaron Duran has a Geek in the City team. So now it's personal. Now on, brother.
Yeah, now we must beat them.
And that's like Cable Hashitani and Dan Clark and our friend Keelan, who I love. But that doesn't mean we're not going to crush them, because we are.
Yeah.
So now it's to the mattresses.
So now, as you're listening to this, if you go to bit.ly/PJBowl.
It's going to be easier in a second because you're going to be able to go to RickEmersonShow.com.
Yeah, you'll be able to go to RickEmersonShow.com. There'll be this link. Go to the link and donate some money so that we can beat the Geek in the City team because they're on our turf now. We have swept to the sweet street. We have done exceedingly well with this Sleep Country thing the last few years.
That's right. And I mean, here's the thing. Never mind. I was blah, 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 lamentations of their women, blah, 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 best in life, blah, blah, blah.
And plus, Rick Emerson will be there in pajamas.
Will I? Yes, I will. Will I?
You are every year, aren't you?
I suppose. That's, I was hoping, that's every year I hope that that'll be forgotten. Every year I hope that that'll be like the element of it that they don't remember. Somebody else should be here, but we can't quite place it. Well, let's bowl. No. Did you? Well, you were there last year.
You say that, but last year you actually even brought them pictures of your face on sticks so they could all look like you.
let's all pretend that I took the time to put those together. That was of course done for us by Cheryl, who was a good person. But see, here's the thing about Cheryl:
it would be a lot weirder actually if Cheryl hadn't done it, and it had been you at home Xeroxing pictures of your own face and then gluing them to sticks.
Here you go. Everyone should be me. The thing about Cheryl is that Cheryl is equal parts benevolence and malice. That's the thing. And so it's like, on the one hand, I mean, she really is, as you know, really like the linchpin that keeps the whole thing going and is, you know, coordinating with the Sleep Country guys. And she last year made the care packages for them and, you know, and a bunch of swag. But then also, yeah, just, you know, like bad picture of me with my face on a stick, you know, for the mocking and the hey and the whatnot. So I'll put that up here in just a second. I don't know what I was going to say.
Well, that was also because you get extra points if your team is like sort of in a theme costume.
That's right.
And so if they all have your face on a stick, no matter what pajamas they were wearing, it was like, look, we're Rick Emerson.
The theme last
and
year was...
Then they get the extra 10 points or whatever for being in a theme costume.
The theme last year was Spongy Nerd, I think. So I'll put that Sleep Country Pajama Bowl link here up in just a few. Don Taylor's tracking the following headlines for you on this Friday.
A woman goes into a rage when she can't get the cupcakes she likes. A man robs Jack in the Box and then returns to buy food. And a DUI suspect says he was driving erratically because of the oral pleasure he was receiving.
Really?
Yes.
Now, where was this at?
This was in Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay, so we'll get to that here in a few. Real quick, I just got to say that I was looking at the soundtrack for this Take Me Home tonight. We just live in the strangest, weirdest time. There was just a confluence of, like, cultures and societal strata. First of all, the cover of the soundtrack looks a lot like it should be, and this is, I'm sure, a marketing thing. It looks a lot like it should be like one of the Glee soundtrack albums. It has that sort of, like, if you didn't know any better, like if you just sort of glanced at it in the store, you go, oh, Glee. But there's so many different layers of the cultural cultural strata present in this. There's so many different threads of the tapestry woven together. So the color scheme is all like teal and lime and purple, and it's everybody's look is backlit and looks like they kind of got feathered hair. So there's that, and then it says "Take Me Home Tonight," and then the word "tonight," the O, is like solid, but it's crossed with the shadow silhouette of somebody doing the devil horns. So there's that. This is like on one of those songs like by the Heights, where it has to put every instrument, they have to put every instrument into the song, and like the band has to contain one person of every ethnicity on earth. And then the tagline for the film is "Best period night period ever period," which is sort of interesting and not like at all an 80s thing.
No, that's not an 80s thing at all.
And then I'm looking at the soundtrack. The soundtrack is actually kind of interesting, but again, it's like everything on earth. I wonder what this movie is about and who it could possibly star in terms of like the characters. Listen to this lineup. I'm just going to give you it's a whole bunch of like 80s things, mostly. We've got the Buggles, Duran Duran, Matt and Tori, I'm not sure who they are. The Buggles, Duran Duran, Yaz, baby. Motley Crue, NWA, Kim Carnes. This is the thing where they do sound. This is like snippets from the film. Because later on it's Matt and Barry. And it's only 18 seconds. It's the Buggles, Duran Duran, Yaz, Motley Crue, NWA, Kim Carnes, Men Without Hats, Dexy's Midnight Runners, Wang Chung, Pete Townsend, Atomic Tom, and then a band that I thought only I remembered. Let me ask you right now, is there a song, and when I say a hit song, it doesn't have to have been a smash hit, but a song that was played on the radio, a song, it's not like it was a B-side that nobody ever heard, a song played on the radio, but you are the only person you know who remembers it. Where you go, do you remember that song? And then it goes, no, I've never heard that.
Possibly, but I can't think of it at the moment.
Okay, there has been this song for years. I mean, since 24 years, since 1987, I think, which is when this came out. And are you looking at the soundtrack?
No, I was just looking for the overview of the movie. Again, like Michael Ian Black is indeed listed 10th,
awesome.
Just above Bob Odenkirk and Angie Everhart.
What movie is this? So here's what we're doing.
But below Dimitri Martin and Michelle Trachtenberg.
Aww. Listed below Shiny Hair. That's just sad. Boy, you want to talk about an actress that just went from universally loved to just loathed by about 80% of the people who watched her on a weekly basis. Anyway, so but on this soundtrack is a song by a band that over the years I have mentioned to people. And I would say, hey, do you remember that song? And they go, no, how does it go? And I go, you know, it's a Sims song. You know, and they say, no, I've never heard that. And
I have no idea what you're actually doing.
Well, I don't want to give it away quite yet.
Oh, okay.
But it's a song that only I have never, I mean, on the internet I've seen it referenced. Like, I actually started looking it up at one point to see if I had hallucinated the song and if it didn't really exist. But except for, like, looking it up on the net, which is, again, by definition, you are searching only for those people who've already mentioned it, I have never met anybody else that knew this song. And it's actually on the soundtrack. So that's bizarre. Anyway, so we'll play that here in just a few. So it's just a whole thing. All right.
Anna Faris is in this movie.
I dig me some Anna Faris.
I do like Anna Faris.
I like Anna Faris before she had the plastic surgery and got all trout-lipped. Because, you know, you see her now and she kind of looks like she got to be flopping in a riverbank somewhere. That's no good. Okay. How was your evening, Don Taylor?
My evening was fine. My evening was good. Nothing much to speak of. Although I ended up not taking care of some business that I needed to take care of. So I have to go to Mormon Book Club tonight without a homemade snack.
Were you supposed to make it? Was it your turn to bring snacks? Or does everybody bring snacks?
Everybody. Basically, it's food club and we talk about books. But we didn't meet last month, so it's basically we're talking about two books. But, you know, everybody brings... there's usually a theme for the food, but and everyone brings something. And it's always a kind of a crapshoot. It's fun to see. It's like, is it going to be... Last time, it was actually kind of a balanced meal. We had a main dish, and we had vegetables, and we only had two desserts. So sometimes it's like, it turns out everything is fried, or like everyone but one person brings a dessert or something. And then there was one month I wasn't there that I missed that the theme was pie, and everyone brought a pie, and only one of them was savory. And I missed that one, but apparently everyone went home just feeling kind of ill. But the theme this month is that it's supposed to be a food that a recipe that has appreciated with time, something that you know is valuable to you, something that you enjoy every single time, no matter how many times you eat it. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I ran out of time and I didn't cook anything, so I'm just going to go to Trader Joe's and get cheese and pub cheese and crackers.
You say I have no idea what I would even pick for that. What do you mean? Give me another example of it. In other words, it's a food that when you say it's appreciated with time.
I don't know. It's like if it's something that perhaps you didn't enjoy once, but now...
Oh, it's grown on you.
It's grown on you, and you always enjoy it.
Okay, fair enough.
No matter how many times you eat it.
I don't even know what that would be. I have nothing for that.
I was thinking about making a small lasagna or something. Or actually, I was thinking about perhaps making tuna casserole because I never...
Love me some tuna casserole.
Never had tuna casserole when I was growing up. And it's such a food that is the butt of so many jokes. Like, ew, tuna casserole. Mom's tuna casserole. And I literally never made tuna casserole until about 4 years ago. And it was one of those sort of desperation, we're poor, and I have the world's biggest can of tuna that I bought at Cash and Carry. What are we going to do with that? I guess I can make tuna casserole.
We've got to use it up.
And I did, and I was like, oh my God, tuna casserole is great.
It really is. That's one of the two dishes I can make, by the way. The two things I can make, I mean, not counting like thawing things, I can make a tuna casserole. And then I can make tuna pinwheels. And tuna pinwheels is just like if you just subtracted the noodles. So it's basically the tuna, you know, and the mushroom soup or whatever. And then it's just you make and then roll out. And you got to make it because, like, you know, because I can't tolerate, like, Bisquick or crap like that. But you make and then you roll out biscuit dough. And then you put the tuna, you know, the sort of tuna casserole thing, inside of it, roll it up. You're basically making it into a cinnamon roll, but it's not sweet.
Oh.
So it's like you make cinnamon rolls out of biscuit dough, if that makes sense.
That sounds delicious.
But instead of, it is sort of, it looks like a cinnamon roll and it's made that way, but it's biscuit dough and then the tuna filling, and it's fantastic. And I know it's probably trashy and it just makes me just a freaking hick or whatever, but that's fine. But that's one of the two things I can make. Because if you had to, like, if you looked at a pie chart or whatever of my childhood, and you looked at the meals that were consumed most frequently in my home, tuna casserole, tuna pinwheels would be the top of the list. And tamale pie.
Tamale pie.
Which I can't make, by the way.
I don't know. I have never made tamale pie from scratch.
Yeah.
But when I was growing up, one of the dinners we would have occasionally was the shilling tamale pie in a box.
Shilling.
That you just scramble up the hamburger and then add the packets of things. And then my job was I got to put the whole tamale topping part on it. And I loved that. And then about 5 years ago, I don't think they sell it anymore, but for a few years, Safeway would sell these giant frozen things of like lasagna and stuff, like family size dinners. And they had one that was tamale pie, and it was delicious. It was so good. And I keep meaning to make that thing. I need to learn to make tamale pie because it's just the best thing ever. The tuna casserole thing, my first tuna casserole, I made the recipe that was in my big giant Cooks Illustrated book. And Cooks Illustrated, of course, being the people who do the America's Test Kitchen and that stuff. And so they make they refine every single recipe for everything until it's absolutely perfect. And then they explain to you all in these esoteric terms. So it's like totally geeky, like wanky stuff. But the recipes are guaranteed to be perfect. And so I made the tuna casserole. And of course, you have to make like, you know, the bechamel sauce from scratch and do the this and then that and saute your onions and add the thing and the stuff and put it together. And it was amazingly delicious. And I made it that way the first couple of times. And then like about 2 months ago, I was like, oh, what the hell? Let's just try it with the mushroom soup.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know something? The kind that you work really hard for is not that much better.
Yeah.
It's really not worth the amount of out of work.
Well,
and so now from now, whenever we make it, it's like it's just the mushroom.
Well, especially
soup.
Because you're making it because it's basically, I mean, made of just a few staples. I mean, it's noodles and it's tuna fish. And then it's, you know, if you're making like the pinwheel thing, it's like biscuit dough. But if you're making the casserole, then you're using like your Campbell's soup or whatever, which is a pretty unimpeachable soup at this point. I'm not saying it's not one of your fancier soups, but at the same time, there's nothing like there's no one on earth who will tell you that Campbell's makes a bad soup as such.
And cream of mushroom soup is a solid ingredient for certain things. You know, it is a good binder for your a little fat and moisturizing binder for your casserole.
So like about you, you know, it's a big tent where you are.
It does its job.
You're not, you're not snooty. I mean, you are, but you're snooty in the same way that like we all are. You're snooty in a sort of marbled esoteric way. You know, that it's not, you don't dismiss things out of hand just based on what category or class they may happen to be in. And I like that about you, Don Taylor.
Thank you very much.
You know what song is not on the Take Me Home Tonight soundtrack?
What?
Take Me Home Tonight. Mm-hmm.
My favorite thing about that song, in fact, the only thing I really like about that song is the story that I read years ago when Eddie Money approached Ronnie Spector because he wanted her to do that little Be My Little Baby part in the song. And the story went that he called her up on the phone and said, "Hey, Ronnie, what are you doing?" And she said, "Just the dishes, honey."
Awesome.
And then she did the stuff in the
song. Thing about Eddie Money is... Eddie Money is—he's the strangest guy. And I know that this sounds like something that people say, and they're kidding when they say it. But Eddie Money is really fascinating to me because, on the one hand, I don't know. On the one hand, everybody knows who he is. I mean, you know, he's got a pretty high recognition, etc. I mean, even I would imagine among younger people of a certain stripe, if you're a classic rock enthusiast, which a lot of kids are, you know, classic rock seems to be a thing that X number of teenagers glom onto. You know, you hit 16 and suddenly you just want to listen to just Hendrix records or something all the time. So if you're there and you grow up listening to KGON or whatever, everybody kind of knows Eddie Money. And yet everybody at the same time, he seems like he's halfway to being a punchline, but not quite.
Yeah.
And then here's the other thing. You also think of him as being a B-lister. But then you look at it, like the Billboard charts, and you realize he's had like 17 top 10 hits. I mean, he's had more top 10 hits than, I'll put it this way, he sold more records than the Ramones ever did. So there's that. And then there's the thing of like, well, he's kind of a rock star, but he's not really a rock star. He's a rock singer. Nobody would ever, I think, call Eddie Money a rock star. You call him a rock singer,
a
maybe a performer. And then that goes
to the recording artist Eddie Murphy, Eddie Money.
Exactly. And here's the proof of that. You look at him at you watch the video for Take Me Home Tonight, and it's that thing that you see so often in the 80s, but it's where he's just standing. I think he's actually standing in a boxing ring, but he's standing in a boxing ring in the middle of an arena that is filled with no one. There's no one there. And not only is there no crowd, there is, in fact, no band. Which then, that sort of leads you to the whole thing. Like, does he have a band? Are there just guys who wake up and they check their voicemail and they go, "Ah, crap, I'm recording for Eddie Money today," and they just get called in? I mean, I always wonder about guys like that. That you listen to them and it is clearly a whole band performing, but it's just them. They're the guy who is just listed as the sole performer. There really is no band as such.
Yeah, I was listening to my Barry Manilow Pandora station the other day. And they played a Stephen Bishop song. And I hadn't thought of Stephen Bishop in, like, forever. And I realized, I used to love Stephen Bishop. And it's like, when was the last time you heard anything from Stephen Bishop or even thought of Stephen Bishop? But he was huge in the 80s. Absolutely massive.
It is. It does seem to be really just a crapshoot. Who becomes... How do I put this? Who is still viewed as being famous? Well, we've had this conversation many, many times. The certain people just remain A-listers even after they're not really. Like, you know, Jon Bon Jovi is an A-list rock star. He is and always will be. It's not like he moves as many records as he used to. He doesn't have a lot of like number one singles now. But you know what? No. He is a star and will always be a star.
Yeah, he's reached that point where he will never be washed up.
Yeah.
He may not like sell as many or even any records anymore. But he will never be somebody that is seen on the decline.
Right.
You know, it's like same way with Steven Tyler.
Right.
You know, somebody else in his position, some other musician who had sold the amount of records he did, doing something like American Idol, could be seen, you know, as his career is somehow on the decline. But it doesn't. His career is never going to be on the decline. He's always going to be Steven Tyler.
And yet Eddie Money's a guy, you just sort of, whenever I try to conjure up an image of him, he's just sitting in a Dodge Dart waiting for a guy to bring him, you know, like some booze or something. Yeah. That's it. I only ever saw him interviewed one time. The thing about interviewing Eddie Money is, and he was a cop too, is the weird thing about Eddie Money, that he was a cop in Brooklyn. And at some point he's like, I've had it with being a cop. I'm going to be a rock singer. And then like, bam, it happened, which... Like, I don't know how that just... I mean, it seems like that's a thing that doesn't just... You can't just sort of will that into existence. But I saw him interviewed one time as by a DJ I know. And it was weird because he sat slumped in the corner. And he just was pale and wrinkly and just looked terrible. You know what he looked like? He looked like that little wooden puppet that Jigsaw always sends out on the tricycle before he kills somebody, minus the red swirly things. If you were just to take the red swirly things off his cheeks, he goes, hello, I'm here to interview you. I'm Eddie Money. But it's like he was just sitting slumped in the corner like a marionette with his strings cut. But then, like it was that thing where you want to go like, God, do we need to have like defibrillators? Do we need a shot of adrenaline? And then as soon as the mic light goes on and the DJ goes, joining us now in the studio, Mr. Eddie Money. Hello, sir. And it was like somebody put a quarter in that Zoltar thing in Big. He just went, drink. Why, hello, it's the Money Man here in the studio with you. Ready to rock. Ready to bring it to the middle of Spokane. And then as soon as the interview was over and the light went off, he just went, and just collapsed back like a bad crumpled accordion into the corner again. It was so weird. All right, that's it. Except for these two observations. One.
Okay.
I was going to make an observation about... was it Shilling? Shillings? The seasoning salt people?
Yeah, Shilling. Yeah.
Who was the other? Lowry's.
Lowry's.
That was the guy. And it was like they would just... Here's the thing that I was fascinated by as a kid. And I don't know if this is a trademark of the Shilling Company or if Lowry's makes this too or if everybody has their own equivalent of it. I was fascinated as a child by the huge-ass, like, plastic container of... seasoning salt.
That's Lowry's. Lowry's actually in the 60s, maybe going back to the 50s, I'm not sure. But originally, they were a chain of steak restaurants. And the seasoning salt was the stuff that was on the table. And you would, you know, put it on your steak.
What is that stuff?
It's it's salt with some sugar added to it and like paprika. A little bit of chili powder. And basically, if you put a little bit of it on your tongue and taste it, it tastes a little bit like barbecue sauce. You know, it's sugar and a few different basic seasonings.
My two favorite seasonings when I was a child, I went through this whole thing where, like, seasoning salt, like, there was no food, in my opinion, that was not improved by the addition of seasoning salt. The second was lemon pepper.
Lemon pepper is a weird ingredient, but it's very good on chicken.
It was a thing that I would just put it on anything, like things that didn't make any sense. Like my mom would just bring me like a ham sandwich, and I'd be like, "That's great. Where's the lemon pepper?"
There was a salt-free seasoning agent that they used to sell at like health food stores when I was a kid called Spike. And Spike was absolutely delicious on pretty much anything.
Was it like a seasoning salt, sort of a conglomeration?
It was, except I believe it was actually salt-free. But yeah, it was a whole bunch of like herbs and spices mixed together. And it was like every time, if you went to, it was on the table at every vegetarian and hippie restaurant, you know, when I was a kid. And I'm sure they probably still sell it. But that was one of those things that, yeah, I would put that on everything.
You know, here's my fun, speaking of life when we were young, when things were better and simpler, Don. Yeah. Here's the thing that my wife and I were talking about a couple days ago, because I swear to God, we'll get all this wrapped up here in a second. But so I mentioned that Lara's been sick the last few days. She finally went back. I shouldn't say this, but she finally went back to work today, not because she's well, but just because she said she just couldn't take another day of sitting at home, you know, like kind of doing nothing. And she said she reached the point where even the dogs, even poor idiot Philo, was starting to irritate her. And he doesn't do anything but just sit in the corner and look afraid. And she was like, I just can't take another day. I'm going to work.
She's just looking over him, going, grow a spine.
Yeah, no, I was, no, it's like I.
Man up.
I walked to the house the other night, and it's like, I walk in and the dogs immediately start jumping around because they're all glad to see me or whatever. And then Philo immediately ran over and looked up at her with those beseeching, like, you know, mother, pay attention to me eyes. And she just looked at him and she just said, oh, go away. And kind of went back to her crossword puzzle or whatever. But the one thing is, when she is ill, and this is one of those things that in a couple, you learn early on. When my wife is ill, there are three things that she wishes to have. Those are the Kleenex or whatever with, like, the lotion in them, like, you know, the soft, like, tissues that don't shred your face. That, she likes a chicken noodle soup, and then the third thing, and she only likes this when she is ill. It's like food that you only like when you're pregnant or whatever. She only wants this when she's sick, is those chicken and a biscuit crackers.
We were just talking about chicken and biscuit crackers.
You just
crackers.
Did like a full-on McRib thing.
No, right? on Ham-Fisted Radio. Bobby and I, day before yesterday, we were talking about snacks, and we were both talking about the chicken and the biscuit cracker.
That is her favorite cracker, but only when she is sick. The rest of the year, she has no desire for them. But when she gets ill, when she becomes ill, she will send me a text. She's like, I'm sick. Could you get me crackers? And I know immediately. It's got to be like soup and the puffs tissues and the chicken and a biscuit. So we're having this whole discussion about chicken and a biscuit and how what an old person cracker it is.
Yeah.
And it is like a thing just made for Bridge Club, I think. But then we realized that we both, independent of one another, had grown up eating, loving, and now are missing a certain cracker. And that cracker is the Veggie Thin, which they no longer sell.
Those were really good.
And they were shaped like vegetables.
Yeah.
And they had like a weird kind of spicy flavor to them.
And then they had like these weird little dried bits of vegetables in them.
And here's the thing is like, we all ate those as kids, but don't they seem like they were for old people?
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, what was the... But you're now the third person that had been like, yeah, Veggie Thins, yeah. But then they just... The first thing, they did it in waves. First, they got rid of the ones that were shaped like vegetables. They just started making... They were just square. They stopped making them in the shape of vegetables, and that was the writing on the wall right there. And then they just took them off the market altogether. Now, I've heard tell that they have come back, but that they don't taste the same.
Mm.
So, see, that's one of those things like this song I was talking about earlier that I thought only I remembered.
Yeah, I asked Patrick to get me crackers the other day because I had some pub cheese, but I had no crackers. And he was at the store, and I said, well, get me some crackers because I got pub cheese. Not thinking that I had to specify the crackers. He comes back, and he brings me, like, the Keebler Club crackers, which are good, don't get me wrong, but they are not the right crackers to go with the pub cheese.
No, they're not. No, it's a very specific kind of...
Yeah.
Well, it's like my brother, every holiday season for Christmas, my brother makes, the big cheese ball with the, and that's a thing my dad used to do, and then it's like my brother sort of took that over, and my brother's very particular about it. He's like, very, like, exactly, certain mix of cheeses and a certain blend of and a certain kind of, like, walnut or whatever that's, like, that he has to, like, crush up himself, and he's very, very, very particular about it. And at one point, his wife went to the store, and she came back with, knockoff Wheat Thins. Knockoff Wheat Thins, and I think like Triscuit like crackers or something. And he just, he was just very stridently insistent, which I understand that it was like there was nothing that could work with those except for actual Triscuits and actual Wheat Thins. And he actually says that he can't tolerate anything but the Wheat Thins himself because it's about the Wheat Thins having that little layer of sugar on them that then tastes good with the cheese. We've done that thing again, except it's just us, where now I'm hungry. And there was not even Kelly Clark here doing it. Now it's just me.
No, it's just us talking about food, as often, as always.
Should have made Jim bring us something.
When Michael Ian Black earlier, we were talking about his podcast about Mike and Tom Eat Snacks, and apparently there is some other radio show, podcast or something that's called like Snack Time or something like that, and they do a whole thing about snacks. He said the guy sent him a nasty letter and was angry at him and saying that they'd stolen his idea, which just made him feel bad because as he said. Calling a comedian a thief.
Right, it's like the worst thing you can do.
It's like using the N-word, basically, as far as comedians are concerned. Yes, your thing existed before our thing, but it's not like you're the only people who eat snacks.
Right, right.
You know?
Well, I mean, snacks, I think, are consumed by, let's say, most people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I... No, he should tell the guy to get bent. That should be his response. So forth. Well, we should take a break here. We'll come back on the other side with Big Jim Willing, another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 today, talking about Mr. Bob Newhart. We'll play the song that I think only I remember. We'll see if anybody else does. Taser Watch coming up, Penis Watch, Clergy Watch. We'll do clue number 5 in the Name That Snack contest for EH Vending, and we will talk more about the Sleep Country Pajama Bowl and how you must aid us in crushing Aaron Geek in the City Duran.
They're going down.
And then into a powder. And then jumping up and down on the powdery residue that's left over.
While giggling maniacally.
And then snorting it. We'll be back after this. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Stay right there. We return momentarily.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network. Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us. Let's see if I can get this. You know, there's this little noise happening in the back of this, the song here, like mixed way down in the track. Sounds like a guy. I don't know what that's about. But,
what the hell?
But it's like it sounds like a guy like rubbing a straw into and out of like the plastic top on a McDonald's cup. But I thought it was you just continually making the McRib is back noise in the background, and then it turned out to be a horse. So Rick Emerson apologizes for the error.
Thanks.
I'm not saying you sound like a horse, baby. Really, I'm not. Yeah, I don't know why that's there. Thank you for joining us. It is 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Mr. Big Jim Willig with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. We have put up the link for the Sleep Country Pajama Bowl. You go to rickemersonshow.com. It is the first blog entry, and there's no other additional information right now, just the link. But it's the Sleep Country Pajama Bowl link. That is at rickemersonshow.com. The actual link is really, 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 really long, apparently, so we put up like a sort of shortened URL of it. So that's right.
Is it going to be at the same place that it was last year?
I believe
it's
at Big Al's in Vancouver. I think that's where it is every year. I don't know definitively, but I believe that's where it is.
Well, if that is the case, then perhaps Jenny's husband will buy nachos again.
Oh, my God. Those nachos. You described it best. You're saying it was like a mall made out of nachos.
It was, it was just like this insane, sort of mini mall of nachos. It was just each layer of the nachos, each should have been a meal unto itself.
Well, on the front, there was like, ground beef. And then on the back, though, there was like a whole little, there was like a cabana of chicken.
Yeah.
And then there was a little like a topiary of, it just had like lots of like great lettuce and cilantro. And then on the other side, there was,
then your strata of chips, and then like the second floor has like beans and some kind of ground beef and more cheese. It was like the thing was massive.
It was like 15 pounds. I mean, it was huge. Here's the thing about nachos. Nachos seem like they. This is the sort of thing that just frustrates me, and it shouldn't. It shouldn't make me angry, but it does. And I know that is like the story of this show. That it's things that shouldn't make me angry, but they do. I mean, the story of the Rick Emerson Show is the story of disproportionate anger, both ways. That, like, I don't really care about most stuff that I should, polar ice caps, but I mean, the dynamic of the show is, and I think has always been, like, mountains into molehills, molehills into mountains. The thing about nachos is, God damn it, they ought to be easy to make. There's no excuse for bad nachos.
No.
Because we all know what good nachos taste like, and we all know how to ruin them. By the way, here's how you ruin them. You put on all of your condiments as early as possible, and then you make them just so they can turn everything into sludge. And also, never have enough chips. Always make sure that you ladle on like more beans or something than there are chips, so that it just becomes this horrible gelatinous brown cement at the end.
I like nachos in theory. But the reality of nachos is usually not good for me personally because they
make you messy.
Well, they fly in the face of all of my own personal food issues, too, where I have these weird things about eating things evenly and getting the same amount of everything, in each bite. Which is why, like my sandwiches all have to be like everything on the sandwich has to be like the same and all the way out to the edges and that sort of thing. Nachos are really difficult because, even if I make them at home, which I have done occasionally, I get like so anal retentive about it. It's like, the layer of chips, but I have to make sure there's like meat on every single chip, and then the cheese has to be evenly distributed. And then, you have to eat them very quickly because very quickly the juices soak into the chips, and then so you have this bottom layer of squishy chip.
Yeah, nobody
wants
that.
Want squishy chip. You want crunchy chip, and all of my just insane anal retentive food issues just go crazy with nachos. I just get anxious.
Some of the best nachos I've ever had in my life. Let's just do this. About the Seamus sent this to us because I believe that Jim Willig has not yet weighed in with a song that will be your entrance music, your theme song. And so Seamus sent this to the new Kim Kardashian single.
Oh, God, no.
Joining us now on the Rick Emerson Radio program, Mr. Big Jim Willig. Hello, sir.
How's it going? What do you think of the hot pants?
He just said, I think we found Jim's new entrance song.
Even with the auto-tuning, she sounds retarded.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, my God.
All right. I'll just make that go away.
Finding yet another reason to hate myself.
Yeah. The thing about it is that he sent this to us. I don't know what the time frame was, but I get a feeling it wrapped the earth in like a minute and a half because... On the way to the studio, I get this email from Seamus like, oh my God, have you heard the new Kim Kardashian? It's the worst thing ever. It's got 9,000 thumbs downs on YouTube or whatever. And he, he's like, you got to tell everybody. By the time I walk into the studio, Sarah and Greg had discovered it, listened to it, found out how awful it was, and then just put it on a loop and were subjecting you to it.
Yeah.
So.
That's mean.
Yeah.
Well, let's see how many, that is the radio equivalent of locking someone in a locker.
Right now, it's got 3,000 likes, 48,000 dislikes.
Here's the thing. The song, as best I understand it from listening to it, is she is in a discotheque of some sort. And the DJ is playing her jam.
Like you do.
And she would like him to turn it up. So she can dance the night away.
So it's a song like a riddle. You have to kind of decipher it.
Yes.
Yes, like your Gollum.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. It's
one song to bind them.
By the way, the most recently posted comment on YouTube just says, "Wow, my dog just ran through a glass door." So there you go. All right. We'll just end that there. Hello, Big Jim. How are you, sir?
Hello. I had actually figured out what song I want to use as my theme song, but I forgot to get it off of YouTube and send it to you.
What is it going to be?
It'll be Primus's basically the Bastards theme.
Okay, fair enough. We'll have that for next week.
Thank
so
you.
You look bad, but you sound tired. You seem like you're sort of scraping yourself off the floor today.
It's been a long week, and I've done comedy in both Eugene, actually just outside of Eugene in Springfield, which I know sounds like a lot happier, more cartoonish.
Say no more.
Yeah. It was 75-cent beer night at this place. And the true comedy in that was the place was virtually deserted.
Oh.
Like, even the promise of 75-cent PBRs could not roust people from their beds and homes to come to listen to Comedy Gold. And what was worse was I didn't have the flow with me that day. And I've decided, though, I'm going to be doing something different. I bring my laptop on stage with me, and I'm going to simulcast my sets now via chat roulette live on the web. If I'm doing a comedy in a bar that has Wi-Fi, I'm going to be doing that from the here on out.
Awesome.
So I did that 2 days ago. Last night I was in Salem at the aptly named Coffee House Cafe.
Just stupid.
Which, you know, the redundancy on that is obviously pretty bad. Coupled with that, comedy and stimulants, you never usually a good thing. Because
right.
You want people really kind of like amped up and analytical of your material. But I got to say, a very, very intriguing audience, very much kind of Dungeons and Dragons oriented, strangely enough.
This is in Ashland?
This was in Salem.
Salem.
Yeah.
At the Coffee House Cafe.
Yes, the one and only world-famous Coffee House Cafe. For the last comedy show that they'd be doing there, possibly forever.
Are they closing?
No, they're done with comedy,
I think. They're just, screw this, it's not
done,
working.
They're done with people with senses of irony coming down there and throwing it in their faces.
Well, it's funny,
every week.
When you said 75-cent beer, like, Dawn and I immediately, like, felt sympathy. For one reason, and then he said, and plus no one came. And so, like, then we just felt bad for, like, a whole different reason.
Yeah, I had this image of you in, like, one of those nightmare things where you were having to perform behind a chain-link fence. Yeah,
bottles and ashtrays are hurled at my face and head.
Now, do you have like an agent, or because probably a lot of people out there are interested in comedy and how it works. How do you get gigs? How do you get bookings?
Well, Portland is blessed in the fact that its comedy community is expanding rather exponentially. Because of which, it's easy because people are going out and they're finding more and more venues to do. The problem is they need more and more comics to kind of fill that bill. I've been around long enough that people will just basically ask if I'm available during a certain time. I'm like, sure. So I get more of my gigs kind of thrown at me than I really have to do.
So people know you. People will.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's kind of a bit of a networking kind of a deal. You basically just go to the open mics, show your stuff until you've established yourself as being consistent enough. And then comics who are already going on a gig will bring you along to do like a guest set.
Is that true? So will comics... Because I wonder about, I'm always fascinated with people in, you know, careers that are different than my own and how it works. Is that the deal that when you think, well, okay, you're living in a town, you go to the open mic night, you do the open mic night there, but there's all these other towns in the world. How do they know you to book you? And so is it that other comics will ask you to come along, or they'll tell the club, you got to get this guy in Portland, or?
Basically, what will happen is a booker will take the word of at least – usually it's like two other comics that they've booked for a good long time and established themselves with this booker. And someone will apply to them, send them their resumes and their things. And then this booker will talk to the comedians and say, what do you know about this guy?
Right.
And the comics will either give them a thumbs up or thumbs down a la Caesar style. And should it be good enough, then he gets to basically get booked and paid. Or – Route number two is the comic that's already booked on the thing will take you, have you drive the entire time in your car, chipping in a little bit for gas and giving you the opportunity to kind of like showcase and get your face and talent out
there. To be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've done that a couple times.
And that probably is a thing where, because you're tempted to think, well, you know, comedians are all, you know, they're always going to just invite some guy who's not as good as they are, so they're not overshadowed. But that's probably not going to work, because then the club owner is going to be like, hey, the guy you recommended sucks. F you.
Yeah.
So you get, but it serves, so they, it is their vested interest to recommend somebody who is good.
Yeah. Harvey's has operated like that for years and years and years. The only problem is if you're good at one particular level, usually the lower levels, you don't get to move up at all. So, I worked Harvey's for I don't know how many years. And because I did such a good job as an MC, I couldn't move up to the feature spot, which is the middle guy. I just got stuck kind of doing my little bit of time in the beginning and then like kind of bringing up the other comics and kind of keeping the audience interested and corralled throughout the rest of the show.
You were such a good host that they were like, well, we can't. We got a million comics. We don't have a million. We've only got one good host, so you're it.
So pretty much, it was like, why move him up if he's doing such a good job there? And, you know, when I was working in the radio, people would come down, they'd hear me on the air, they'd come down to see me perform and be like, well, why is it that, you know, we're not watching you for like a half an hour? Why is it we have to wait for somebody else? I'm like, fill out the comment card. Supposedly that's what
ask him.
Yeah, ask you, pass the buck to this dude. So eventually I just told Barry, the guy that books the place, I'm just like, you can either book me as a feature or you can lose my phone number subsequently. Strangely enough, I haven't been called back. Yeah.
Wow. It's a series of up endings today.
Yeah, really.
No one showed up. It is serious, and I hate to, and I don't mean to go back and just sort of lean on this, but when you say that it was like, you know, 75-cent beer night, and yet like the crowd was still light. I mean, when you say like a light crowd, because I have no idea how many people turn out for a comedy show like on an average night for not, you know, and it's as you said, you're known, but you're in this part of town. You know, you're in this part of the country more often than, you know, somebody who is, you know, some sitcom performer who's just touring once every couple of years or whatever.
Yeah.
So for your average comedy turnout, like, what is that like? Are you talking, is an average night 15 people in the crowd or 100 people or 20 or?
Well, I would say that night there was a table of four, and then there was another table of about three. So I'd say 7 to 10 people, including the other comics that were also performing.
I'd say that is still more people than saw Screech when he was here. So
I was in that crowd.
Me too.
Because there was...
How bizarre is that?
It was Richard Cheese opened.
Yes.
And then Screech came out and did his material.
So there was only like five people, and it was like two of them were you and I. Oh, wow.
I was in Bend when he was through for that. And he was
missed a delight.
He was at the comedy club in Bend. And my friend and I, we were there. It's like her father had to be put into a home. And we were down there to like pack up the house and do serious business. But we were driving by the comedy club, whatever the comedy club is in Bend. And it said on the marquee, Saved by the Bell's Screech. Did not actually say, list his actual name. It just said, Saved by the Bell's Screech.
We
came so close to going, and I'm
glad you didn't.
But because we knew it would be a train wreck, but at the same time, it was like Dustin Diamond's going to be, and we should go see Screech, and it didn't
The thing
happen.
Is, though, with a comedy club, a name like Dustin Diamond sounds like a cheesy stage name as it is. So had he gone with Dustin Diamond, I think more people would have gone out of just like, oh, that sounds like a professional comedian. I'll go see that. And then you're like, oh, wait, Screech? Yeah. Oh, I got duped.
It was,
what the F?
And I know that, you know.
I like that in Bend that they thought that was the sales technique, though. That was the goal that was going to get asses in the seats was, you know, no, it's Screech.
And the thing is, like, it was just so mishandled because, I mean, A, not funny, but also, but leaving that aside, like whatever anybody, you know, I know that he's not everybody's taste, but whatever anybody thinks about Richard Cheese, that guy puts on a show.
Oh, a hell of a show.
I mean, he's, you know, and other people not necessarily fans of his sometimes, but he's an entertainer in the sense that, like, it's like a five-person band, and they can play. I mean, that band of his can really play. He's, like, doing the costume changes. He's going out to the crowd. He's taking requests. He's, you know, and he's, like, bringing people up on stage, and he's doing the banter. And it's like, you know, he very much puts on an entire show. So, good, bad, or indifferent, there's like a kind of a spectacle going on, and then he does the big like finale wind up and thank you, good night, da da da, pow, pow, pow. And then it's like the big headliner is just like the sad guy with the white man's fro on stage in a G.I. Joe shirt going, ah, you know, and then like the
Radar O'Reilly, Gary Bergeroff is going to be your headliner this evening.
God damn. And it was like at one point, it was so funny that we were both there because there was like no one there, and it became apparent early on. Like I thought, like, oh, oh, God, this is so, I mean, like, this is so much worse than I anticipated. It's so much worse. And it's like you just feel bad for him and for everyone, for the whole human race. And and it's like you feel so bad for him, but it's the thing where it's like you feel so, I hate to make this comparison. It's, you know what it is? This sounds awful, but it's like when someone has a death in the family, and you go over, you know, to condolences and support and whatever, and you realize that you should stay, you know, as long as they need you for whatever they need. But part of you is just like, oh, it sucks here. I got to go home. This place is depressing.
Glee starts in 20 minutes. Yeah, damn,
like,
it.
I got to go walk around in the sun where there's life and happiness and laughter. And that was like a screech. You're watching him on stage, and as it becomes clear that he has no act other than like, I'm Screech, and I hate myself. You're the crowd going, well, this is really sad. Unfortunately, it's so sad I can't stay to provide, you know, solidarity and comfort. And so I was actually timing it. I was waiting until he turned his back at one point to, like, get a bottle of water, and I bolted for the door because I didn't want him to – because the thing is, like, four people, and if I leave, I have reduced the size of the crowd by 25%. And I didn't want him to be like, where are you going to stop? You know, and so I, as soon as he turned around to get his bottle of water, I ran for the door.
Worse, like, just like the you guys met, catch eyes for a second, and he gives you that look like, it hurts me that you're leaving, but if I could, I'd leave too.
I mean, yeah, it's like where you're just, you know, it's like you're watching your guinea pig being taken in to be put down. He's just making you like, no, don't look at me. It makes it too hard. It was so bad.
See, I remember with where he got on stage, Richard Cheese and everyone else is kind of breaking down their set, and he's up there, which whenever they put musicians and comedians together, that's always the worst because you've got all these people behind you like doing heavy lifting and stuff. It's thoroughly distracting. But he's up there trying to do his material, and the crowd is just heckling him mercilessly, but not with like, you know, you suck or anything like that. It's like, did you F Kelly? You know, just like weird random questions. And after a while, he just stopped. He's like, okay, if you have a question, yell it out. Let's get that out of the way. Did you F Kelly? Yes, I did. Next question. Did you F AC Slater? Yes, I did. Next question. It was just so, you know, uncomfortable that even if he did have really good, strong material, no one would know.
Yeah, you do. I mean, I can't believe I'm making this comparison. But in a strange way, Screech does underscore what Dave Chappelle was talking about the inability to go out and do stand-up. And how it and I know everybody's immediate response is to go like, oh, boohoo, cry me a river, you're rich, you're famous, you're whatever. And I get that. I totally do. But there is such a thing as like loving what you do and loving your job and feeling like you have like a calling, like this is my thing. I'm a stand-up comic, I go out and it's what I do. And if you are then unable to do that, because presumably people, you know, the benefit of having money and you know, a certain amount of success, the benefit of that is you can do whatever you want, right? People, hey, you're rich, you can do whatever you want. Well, if whatever you want is to go out and do stand-up, it then sucks if you can't do it. If that is like – then it's almost like a Greek punishment where, like, you've been so successful that the one thing you want to then do and have the time to do, you can't do because people are just shouting out, I'm Rick James, bitch, at you.
Yeah. You're basically Burgess Meredith at the end of the world with all the books and time and you know, no glasses. But I remember that night vividly with poor Dustin on stage.
You just carry a picture of him in your wallet as like a sort of a there but for the grace of God, you know.
Yeah, it's
like
him and a crying clown.
Yeah, just like, you know, it's just a relative positioner for your place. You know, like, look, I'm not this poor bastard.
Yeah,
right here. So,
yeah.
All right. Oh, hey, we have a birthday announcement that I'm going to give here. Normally, I do a big build up to this, but
okay.
if I do that, I'll forget about it. So we went to God. I'm old. It's not just that I'm old; it's that we're all old. And you know this is true because the email starts with, Rick, I'm old. This is from the mother of Andy, the formerly homeschooled man.
Ah, yes.
Andy, longtime listeners will know him as Andy the homeschool kid, who I think started calling us when he was like a zygote. Andy is now 20, which means that at any moment just, you know, my skin is going to start sloughing off. I'm going to turn into, you know, I'll just become Walter Jameson turning into dust. Andy is 20 today. She said it would make his day if you said something. Just saying. That is from his mom's. So happy birthday, Andy. And
happy birthday, Andy.
Treasure your youth and vitality.
The formerly homeschooled man.
Yeah, so there you go. Let me ask you this. Did you ever have any of the food he brought by?
No.
Because you are, you know, I don't want to say you're a foodie, but you're a person very into food and cooking and whatever. But you're also like, you understand it intellectually. Like, you know what goes in. You know how hard it is to make good food.
Yeah.
And you know, that when you taste something really, really good, you know, like, wow, this person really, they had to work a long time or, you know, trial and error to figure out what. And the thing is, he's just like a vegan, and I'm inherently suspicious of vegan food. We'll have to have him bring these by at some point because he made vegan cinnamon rolls for us one time. I think it was at the tail end of the CBS thing. And I swear to God, no lie, they were not just good vegan cinnamon. They were some of the best cinnamon rolls I have ever had in my life. And I'm a harsh judge of cinnamon rolls. Cinnamon roll, there's a few things that I am a merciless judge on. Cinnamon rolls is one. Iced tea is another.
Interesting juxtaposition.
Well, I've talked about this before. It's like everybody just, like, you know, you go there and it's like it's just like from some crap syrup that they've mixed. Like it's like a fountain iced tea, which is like a bunch of, it's like a Nestle goo that they, you know,
yeah,
that they evaporate into the thing. Or it's like they'll make it and let it sit in a jar in the fridge for like 3 weeks. But cinnamon rolls, that's a thing that everybody thinks they can make, and making a perfect cinnamon roll is hard. Making a pastry at all that is really, really good. His cinnamon rolls are awesome. I mean, they are like scary good, and they're vegan too. So wow. Because he's going to baking school, or
yeah,
I don't know what it is, pastry school or something.
He would like to have a vegan baking food cart at some point. He's talked about that, and
it's quite good. We'll have him bring those by at some point. So we'll do Humor Me Comedy 101 here in just a few. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
A Louisville, Kentucky man is facing multiple charges after police said his car was weaving in and out of traffic. According to arrest records, a police officer with a radar gun observed the vehicle speeding and driving erratically down eastbound I-64 around 2 a.m. on Thursday. Police said at one point the car drove off the road before the driver corrected it. According to arrest records, the driver pulled the vehicle over and asked 31-year-old Jason Kircher why he was driving that way. Kircher told them it was because he was receiving oral sex from his passenger. According to arrest records, the officer smelled alcohol on Kircher's breath and saw an open container of alcohol in the car's console. Kircher failed several field sobriety tests. Police said his blood alcohol level was 0.54%, below Kentucky's legal driving limit of 0.8%. He's charged with careless driving, speeding, and driving while intoxicated.
Now, the story doesn't – maybe I missed this. Does the story identify, like, say who that he was in the car with a person or several people?
It
or
just says that he was receiving oral sex from his passenger. And if you go to our website, to the pictures, you will see – the happiest bunk shot ever.
Oh, this is the photo that says happy to be arrested.
Yeah, he has no real shame.
Well, because I mean,
hey, you know, I got me some, is basically his.
Not just I got me some, it's a matter of public record.
Yeah.
Like, it is a matter of governmental record that, like, a woman, you know, she was giving me the sex.
Or a fella. It said.
Or somebody. He was
somebody, but somebody. Yeah, somebody liked him enough.
Fetching enough to. So that is in the visual aids for, if you go to rickemerson.com/pictures, that is the visual aids for March 4th, rickemerson.com/pictures. But he looks exactly like the kind of guy who would be happy to be arrested for this, by the way.
Yeah, he's like, hey.
He looks like he smells, though.
Here we go, Jim. There he is. That's his mugshot. That is one of the happiest mugshots I've ever. It's like, well, it's kind of like going, what are you going to do?
Well, you know what he's thinking? He's like, I can't wait till the fellas at work read about this in the paper. Yeah, excellent. Well done, sir.
Oh, for all those haters out there that are doubting, don't you even doubt that I got that?
Yeah, seriously. You didn't score with that chick. You're lying. He goes, no. Just ask the cops. They'll tell you.
It's in the paper.
All right.
Okay, let's do our taser watch.
Here's your taser watch for Friday. Taser watch for Friday.
Police officers never know what they're going to get when they respond to a call. This week, officers in Seattle's North Precinct got a naked man who was high on drugs, growling like a dog, and claiming to be the devil. They were sent to the 2000 block of Northeast 105th Street at 10:50 p.m. on Tuesday. A homeowner had complained that a naked man was on his porch growling like a dog. By the time officers showed up, the man had walked on two legs to the front yard. The naked man, whom police said was clearly high, screamed that he was the devil and that, quote, everyone was going to die.
Jesus God Almighty.
Officers tried to talk to him, but he ran back to the house. Police ordered him to halt and lie down. Instead, the man continued to scream and began breaking windows in the house and cutting himself. Officers used a taser to subdue him.
Okay, but see, that's the thing where so often we say, well, like, why do they have to go right to the taser? Why do they stop? You know, why don't they stop it? I'm saying, like, why don't they go right to the gun? I mean, if there's a guy
or
naked,
chemical castration,
barking like a dog, saying, "I'm the devil, and you're all going to die." That you just cure that with a bullet. That's it. That's you cure that with fire.
Why'd you shoot him? Well, what if he was right? Yeah. What if
Look
he was telling
him.
The truth? Yeah.
Jesus.
He
God.
Said he was the devil.
And that he's a break it. Would you say breaking glass?
Breaking windows and then cutting himself with them.
Jesus.
So they tased him, handcuffed him. Seattle firefighters treated him for cuts. He was taken to a medical center and charged with damaging property.
God damn.
I think basic dermatological injuries would be something that the devil could instantaneously heal himself from.
You know, so you would think.
He probably wasn't really the devil.
Well, but I mean, look, you can't take chances. So did it say if they had to, like, tase him repeatedly or something? Because that would be funny if the devil went down easy.
I think he probably went down fairly easy. They just used a taser to subdue him.
First taser just knocked that idea out of his head. Just, wait, I guess I'm not the devil.
Oh, I stand corrected. Oh,
oops. Magic missile. Oh, crap.
Wow. Okay. There's your taser watch for Friday. Magic missile. Did you say, I was behind a car the other day and the license plate or the bumper sticker said, caution, driver carries magic missile.
Nice.
Yeah. So there's your taser watch for Friday. By the way, somebody asked what else was in the running other than Kim Kardashian's song, if you don't pick a theme, a piece of theme music. But the other thing I was considering was Felicity's theme from TV's Felicity.
CW?
Wow. It's been so long.
No, you know, I figure, you know, it's you are a fragile creative flower.
A girl coming of age.
Okay. Here's
it had like a Star Trek-y taste to it.
Yeah.
Sort of did.
Girls, the final frontier.
That's from my collection of the best of WG Snuffy Walden, which is think like only I and Snuffy Walden's mother purchased, I think. Here is Don Taylor.
A woman caused over $400 worth of damage to a cupcake shop after going berserk when they did not have her favorite flavor.
Okay, berserk is the best possible. Of all the adverbs they could have used here, she didn't go, like, crazy or she didn't become irascible. Yeah, but she went berserk.
She went berserk. Police are appealing for help in tracing the customer who fled the shop after smashing glass display cases, throwing cakes at other shoppers, and attacking members of the staff at Sugar Swirls, with a Z, cake shop in Cardiff, when she was told her favorite treat had sold out. She even went over the counter and grabbed the owner's hair. A South Wales police spokesperson confirmed they are looking for a strawberry blonde woman between the ages of 35 and 45, who's about 5'3".
Does her dress smell of fragrant berries? Does she have a little blue dog with her?
No, at the time of the tackle, she was accompanied by two young children.
Well, Holly Hobby wanted for questioning.
Speaking to Wales Online, cake shop owner Sally Dodd said, "The woman went absolutely ballistic when she was told we didn't have the cupcake flavor she wanted. It's called the Sweet Tooth Fairy Cake and is very popular. She didn't even wait for us to tell her if she waited, we could bake some fresh ones for her. You expect a certain amount of risk running a bar or pub, but not a cupcake shop."
No, I wouldn't imagine that you would.
Side effects of the sweet tooth may include mild bitchitude.
I wish that I'd seen this story in advance. I had the worst joke that I would have prepared when you said speaking to Wales Online, and then I would have just had like a.
Oh, that would have been good.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. We've talked about cupcakes, and now we're sort of like, I don't know. It was determined at one point that we're in a cupcake renaissance. Mm. Although, was it you that told me that we're now moving from cupcakes to something else?
Pies. Pies are the new thing.
And is it like the new cake. Is it like a comfort food sort of a thing, or is it just like
cuz? Yeah, just because these things tend to go in cycles. I think the cupcake thing like sort of ran its course.
Cake, I have always thought had, because the flakiness of the texture, there was a lot of air in it, so therefore the substance wasn't quite there. Pie, it's all filling.
No, that's true. Your cake is sort of like, Your cake is like that air-whipped ice cream or whatever, where it's like, you know, there's really nothing inside.
It's aloof. It's not really, you know, invested in your needs.
Yeah.
Pie is there for you. Pie is your friend.
Pie really is a substantive, you know, and Adam Carolla has held forth for, like, you know, at this point, like thousands of man hours about cake versus pie. But pie really is, there's a lot of substance in pie.
Yeah.
You know, there's no wasted space there.
Yeah. Who gets into a cake fight? No one. Pie fight? Count me in.
Totally.
Now, I admit, we've talked about this. I tend to be more of a cake person than a pie person, but I am very, very fussy about my cake. Because the thing is, even though given the option, pie versus cake, I tend to prefer cake. I am disappointed by cake far more often than I am disappointed by pie.
Okay, so you would say that you have pie less, but when you do, you feel like it serves its purpose.
Yeah,
there's more bad cake in the world than bad pie.
There is.
Well, you know, here's the thing about cake. You know what Lara is really into, and Dan Savage of Savage Love wrote a great piece about this in his book Skipping to Gomorrah. He talked about loving those really really cheap ass cakes they sell like at Albertsons. Like in the, you know, the birthday cakes.
The sheet cakes.
And like the gritty frosting,
yeah.
And the weird, which I can't stand. I can't eat that at all, not even a bite.
No, I don't like that. On the other hand, though, I will say that I love the really super cheap fried pies.
Oh, yeah.
That you get.
Oh, dude, yeah.
Like, not even the Hostess?
Not even the Hostess ones. The ones you can get 25 cents a piece and there's some like crazy off-brand.
And it's like a Hot Pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love those.
Wrapped in wax paper.
I love those. Those are fantastic.
Those are delightful.
And they're in the sugary shell.
Mm-hmm.
God damn it. Why didn't you bring food? Didn't you know?
Fail. I didn't know it was Pie Day.
We were just, well, before you came in, we were talking about, what the hell were we talking about? We had a whole thing about food we ate growing up and then like tamale pie and then like
tuna casserole.
Tuna casserole and tuna pinwheels and whatever. And so and now we moved on to the dessert portion of the conversation. So
I have a tuna sandwich in the fridge. Don't, we could share that.
Don't toy with me.
No, you
can't go from pie to tuna.
Yeah,
fish.
You can have half of my tuna
working
sandwich.
Backwards.
What
I'll have to do when I leave is I have to stop by clearly like a Plaid Pantry and get where do we all okay, if you're gonna get one of those fruit pie things, like what flavor do you go for? Same for me, it's cherry.
I really like the berry ones.
Chocolate.
The generic berry.
You're the only person I know that likes the chocolate ones.
Really?
Yeah.
No, Patrick likes the chocolate.
It's like pudding.
It's pudding.
In a shell. Yeah. It's like protected pudding.
They make or they made a coconut cream pie that was the same.
Burn it.
Okay.
The lemon can be very good, but the lemon is very hit and miss because your artificial lemon flavoring can either be like good or not so good, and also depending on how much citric acid they add to give it some bite. So the cherry and the berry are always like, you know, a sure thing, I think, no matter who makes them.
All right. Let's do one more here and root around under the table like a truffle hound.
Preferably pie non-related.
All right. Well, let's do our clergy watch.
Here is your clergy watch for Friday right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Rick Emerson Radio program.
Well, I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. I know not everybody has got a body like you. Cause I gotta have faith.
Here is Don Taylor with your clergy watch.
Now, did you grab those sound files?
Yes,
okay.
I did.
Father Ignatius Curie, a local priest from Brimfield Township, Ohio, was arrested on Sunday night after police found him lying down in the back of his car on the side of the road with a blood alcohol 3 times the legal limit. Police took him to a local jail and put him in a cell. But then he started getting, as they said, a little bit rambunctious and started exposing himself to the police. And as a way of basically keeping an eye on him and keeping him under control, we are lucky enough that they shackled him to a wall and turned a video camera on him,
fantastic.
I guess, so they could watch him like from, you know,
from afar.
This first clip, this will be a little bit of what he was saying while he was shackled to the wall.
I'll give you the Sermon on the Mount. Your Sermon on the Mount is this. Get these bars off of me because I'm getting a rash.
I'm getting a rash?
Yes, get these off of me because I'm getting a rash. There's your Sermon on the Mount. This would be, I believe, Police Chief David Blau explaining why they shackled him to a wall and put a video camera on him.
He had the idea that he wanted to leave. He wanted to run around the apartment.
Well, that'll stop that.
A lot of people do tend to have the idea that they want to leave when they're in jail.
Yes. So he also said, to sum it up, it's as usual at best, he was extremely intoxicated. One of my officers was walking by the holding cell, and he was exposing himself, he said. And so, yes, so they shackled his handcuffs to a chain to the wall, basically, I guess, so he could not run around and could not take his clothes off anymore. Here's the Reverend Curie once again.
Those chains off my hands. Like I'm Jeffrey Dahmer. I'm not.
Not.
So let me understand this. You're not Jeffrey Dahmer. Repeat.
Stop.
You're not.
Not Jeffrey Dahmer. God. People keep saying that.
He is actually a Father Ignatius Curie is a priest with the Holy Ghost Ukrainian Byzantine Catholic Church in Akron, Ohio.
One of the hippest churches around.
I did not expect you to end that with Akron, Ohio.
No.
Nothing Byzantine is present in Akron, Ohio.
I beg to differ.
Here we have him basically, I guess, bargaining with the with whoever might be behind the camera to let him go.
I'll pay you whatever you want. What do you want? What do you want? Really?
Nothing.
You want me to give you a f***? Is that what you want?
Whoa.
You want to give me to, like, be prisoner of sexual slave? Do you understand, sir, what kind of a f*** storm you're going to be under?
Wow. So he's offering to perform the oral favor on the cop.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the brace goes to the cop just goes, huh? The cop is over there just like filling out paperwork and, you know, watching Wheel of Fortune.
Do you want me to be your sexual slave?
It's interesting that was his first go-to. Like, he didn't haggle down from
lawn.
Cash mm-hmm. to menial labor. He just went right to the sexon.
But, and also, we have one more clip. And because Father Ignatius Curie... despite being, you know, a Catholic priest and all, I mean, yes, he has God on his side, but he knows where true power lies.
Oprah Winfrey is going to have her fat down here, and you are going to have your up the wall.
Okay.
Yes, he is threatening to bring Oprah Winfrey down.
Please tell me that in addition to audio that there isn't a video.
Oh, yeah, there is. You can go online and we can find that for you if you want to post it.
What is the
He just looks like a guy. He's just kind of a slender, brown-haired guy. Just looks like a guy.
God damn. And so this what was the instigating incident here? What was the triggering incident?
Police found him lying in the back of his car at the side of the road with a blood alcohol level 3 times the legal limit.
So it wasn't like he was even causing trouble.
No.
He was just laying there just unbelievably like blind drunk.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. All right, there you go. There's your clergy watch. That's a strong one. There's your clergy watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Because I gotta have faith.
It is the Rick Emerson Show. Here's what we'll do. We're actually going to – I'll move up the clue here in a second. We'll do clue number 5 for the E.H. Vinning Name That Snack contest here in just a skosh. And, of course, if you're the first person to correctly identify this week's snack via snack@rickemerson.com, you'll win yourself a heaping collection of consumable wonder from E.H. Vinning. So we'll do that here in just a second. But I'll do it right now because after that I want to play just a bit of this song that I thought for the longest time only I remembered. And we'll see if it strikes a chord with you guys. And then we'll be joined once again by Mr. Big Jim Willig and his Humor Me Comedy 101 today, talking about Mr. Bob Newhart. Yes?
Yes.
All right. It is time for your E.H. Vinning Name That Snack clue for Friday, March 4th, 2011. That is Friday, March 4th, 2011. And again, if you are the first person to correctly identify this week's snack, via snack@rickemerson.com. That is snack@rickemerson.com. You win yourself a large bag, a huge, and really, we were just, Vicky came by, listener Vicky came by yesterday to pick up the bag, and she actually made this noise. She did sort of a ooh when she went to pick it up. So I'm saying there's a lot of snack there.
You should weigh them. Because it is a substantial amount of weight.
Here's probably why we won't do that. We probably won't weigh them because that would mean having a scale in the studio, and that means that eventually we would force each other onto it, and then it would just be public. And we did that at the last studio where Sarah and I had, I mean, I don't even know if it was accurate, but we had one of those scales where it's like you're in your bare feet and then it tells you your fat content or whatever.
Yeah.
And that just, I rue the day that we ever got that thing. That was just, there was just nothing but just like anger and stares, and especially because, you know, when it basically, like Tim Riley stands on it and the scale just says like, you are perfect. good day, you know, and we're like, fine.
Thank you for blessing me with your weight.
Damn.
Well, you could, let me just say, you could bring one of those in, and I would just look at you and go, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Well, you know what they do in the Stern studio? They actually have, when you walk in, the carpet in front of the door is rigged with a scale. It's like wires under the carpet, and you can't enter the studio without stepping on it, and it's projected on a huge sign above the door. It's like there's this huge section of the carpet that functions as a scale, and as soon as you walk in, it goes like, 185 or whatever, like above the door. It's awesome. I mean, it's one of those things that you know somebody was drunk at like 3 in the morning. Like, oh my God, write this down. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's time for clue number 5 for the EH Vending clue. Name.
I'm excited about the clue.
Are you hooting or are you yawning?
I said clue.
Okay. EH Vending Name That Snack Contest. Don't forget, you can contact EH Vending at 360-816-1853. 360-816-1853 in Vancouver or in Portland. You can contact James, the sales manager, at 503-897-8204. That is 503-897-8204. They provide all manner and all-fashioned manner, function, form, and kind of vending services. Everything from a regular, you know, your regular soda and your snacks to the refrigerators into which you can put all kinds of things if you're going to have like, a deli or if you're going to have people bring in their own stuff, into coffee services as well. So you want to contact them by going to ehvending.com. And do please tell them you heard it here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program, won't you? All right, without further ado, ladies and gentlefolk, I give you this week's clue number 5 for the EH Vending Name That Snack Contest. Let me make sure the sugar bit is turned off. Here is clue number 5.
I need you right now.
Let's get lost tonight. You could be my Black Kate Moss.
There we go. That is improbably enough. Clue number 5. For the EH Vending Name That Snack Contest.
Interesting.
All right. So, do you have any idea what it is right now?
Unless Kanye's got his own brand of Snickers, I would say no.
Kanye has his own brand of everything. Do you still, was it, Dom, were you the one that that sent me the link of that thing where they took Kanye West's tweets and they married them to New Yorker cartoons?
Oh, yeah.
It's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the best things I've ever seen in my life.
A couple of days ago, I also think where somebody took Charlie Sheen tweets and then put them on Lolcats.
Really? See, that's so much better than the first thing I saw, which is where they had Charlie Sheen quotes as though they were being said by superheroes. So it was like Batman and then like with the balloon above his head, like, you know, I have cheetah blood or whatever. And that was, but the thing of the Lolcats, though.
Yeah, it's funnier if an adorable cat, you know, is saying, my flaming fists will destroy you.
Well, and like, is everything.
Am I on a drug called Charlie Sheen?
Charlie Sheen, like Lolcats, only have one gear, and that gear is all caps, 5 exclamation marks.
Right.
So, can I just tell you this? This is a little bit of silliness. And you will not be able to escape this, you know, within like about 30 days or so. But we haven't talked a whole lot about this book that's coming out that you can find out more about. You can go to the website is just zombieeconomics.com. That'll be out May 3rd. In conjunction with Lisa Desjardins and a guy named Roger Bridges of the art and our friend Todd the Corpse and a whole gaggle of folks. But there's this book coming up called Zombie Economics, and it's going to be out on May 3rd. You can find out more about it going to that website. It's on pre-sale now if you'd like to get it. But you know, it's that thing where, like, you know, when you have, you know, the agent, like, you know, you get offers for whatever for the book. And then he says, well, like, we've got so-and-so that is offering this. And, like, here's the publisher of this. And this is their offer or whatever. I swear to God, I'm not going to say this is one of the deciding factors. But I will say it was a sign that we had chosen the right publisher when I discovered that among their many, many publications, the first book of Lolcats. And it was like the editor is talking to us and she's like listing off her bona fides or whatever, like books she's edited or things they've worked on. She's like listing like real books by real people, you know, like actual important books, like the Eat Shoots and Leaves. Her name? Lynn Strauss.
Yeah.
Who did Eat Shoots and Leaves. And it's just, you know, of course, we did the Lolcats book. And Lisa, but Lolcats, tell us more. Like, that was, I think that we made ourselves look retarded because, like, that was the most. She's like telling us that she did like Chuck Norris's autobiography. We're like, well, that's great, but Lolcats, let's talk about that. What was it like? So, I have no point there. I'm going to play this little bit of a song, And then we will do today's installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. So we were talking about the movie Take Me Home Tonight, which I guess opens today. Does it open today?
Yeah.
You haven't seen it, have you? You didn't go to like a screener or anything
for
it. And so it's this coming-of-age film apparently set like in the late 80s or something. And the soundtrack has all of these 80s bands. And it's like Dexy's Midnight Runners and Wang Chung and you know, Men Without Hats, Yaz. Which is a thing I only know about because of my wife. But the final track on here is this song that I thought only I knew. And over the last, like, 20-some years, I have mentioned it occasionally to people. I'll say, like, yeah, the 80s, that was a great time. Do you remember that song? And I'll mention the song. And people, like, just give me the blank look. They just give me, like, the slow Homer blink, like they have no idea what I'm talking about. And yet, I opened up the soundtrack today. Here's the song. So I'm going to play this for you here. And you tell me if either of you recognizes this particular track. So this is from the soundtrack to Take Me Home Tonight, which is apparently in theaters now. I'm seeing total confusion.
Completely missed me, I guess.
So this is his band from Austria. And they're called Opus. That was the name of the group. This song is called Live, L-I-V-E. Live is life. I have no idea what that even means. It's like, and he's Austrian, so who can tell what the hell he's, you know. Just a lot of, you know, blah, 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 purification this, blah, 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 cleansing that. But this song was a top 40 single. This reached number, I think, like 32 or something in 1987. I mean, it was a legitimate top 40 single. And the way that you know it was a legitimate top 40 single, well, it was, but also because I heard it on the what was then the Casey Kasem Top 40 Countdown. And you know, this week at number 37, they're an Austrian band called Opus. And this was on the charts for like 2 weeks. But I was going through this like radio nerd phase where I taped the countdown every week on like a Radio Shack, like, you know, like a little tape player thing. And then I would just go back and listen to it over and over and over again, listening to the songs, but then also like just imitating Casey Kasem's inflections because I was an idiot. But this was a song that happened to be on one of those tapes. And I loved the song so much that I actually like filed it away and didn't record over it. And then as the years went on, I sort of forgot about it. And no one has ever known this song but me. Which is strange for a song that had enough airplay that it made Casey Kasem's top 40.
Don't know it.
It's a strange thing. So it was, in a way, I don't even want to say that it's vindicated, but it is almost like a little closing of the circle that after years of thinking that I somehow just lived in some alternate reality and it was the only place in the known galaxy where this song, it was popular, that it actually was popular enough to make it onto this soundtrack. It's the weirdest thing. It's like, I feel like one of those guys who saw the, like, In the Butt Bob episode and then spent 30 years trying to tell people that it was real.
Well, when we talked about my my obsession for most of my life with the 5,000 Figures of Dr. T.
Which I'd never heard of.
And until DVD, you know, and until the internet, when I was actually able to communicate with the world at large and came there being a certain number of other people were going, oh, I love that movie. And it's like, because I spent the majority of my life going, okay, there's this movie. And these kids, and they got these hats and with hands, and it was written by Dr. Seuss, and Hans Conried, and people go, and it's a musical, and people go, I think you just dreamed that.
Well, do you remember there was
how many drugs did you do in college, Don?
The thing a few months ago where I was talking about that primetime animated special cartoon that I'd seen that was sort of like a heavy metal type thing. And it was like, it's about aliens that come down and they challenge Earth to a baseball game, and they have to play a baseball game on another planet. And I was the only...
It's not Galaxy High, is
No,
it?
It's not. It was a thing. It aired in the 80s, and it was called... I found out just because of this audience. After... And again, even with the age of Google, I would Google, like, baseball, alien, animated, 80s. I could never find anything. And I finally just said, You all, here's what I remember seeing when I was a kid. Did I make this up? If I just imagined this? And several people told me that it was a series called, it was a one-time show, it was an animated special called Take Me Up to the Ball Game. And it was a thing that aired on, like, I think ABC in maybe 1982. And I referenced it as being sort of like heavy metal. And it turns out that it was not by that same firm, but it was by a firm who was initially approached to do testing animation for heavy metal. This was one of the things that came out of that test, which is why it always reminded me so much of that. But I spent decades thinking that I would never know it, and I would go to my grave being frustrated and puzzled by that. It was like it was like my own version of the, it was like the second shooter in the grassy knoll. I just couldn't, like, I just would return to it over and over again obsessively. I swear to God, I'll watch the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T at one of these points. I will do that. It's not a thing I'm just going to, you know, mouth at you forever.
And by the way, here's an adorable kitten matched with a quote from Charlie Sheen.
That's awesome. See, it wouldn't do, it wouldn't work if it was like the Sheen quotes with, like, fail dogs or something. It has to be lolcats because they're sort of intelligent and brilliant and evil and crazy and loud. Yeah. And so they are all things that he is.
Well, no, speaking of random 80s things that kind of existed for a brief period of time, I had the same sensation going on with a TV show that I used to love watching. Couldn't remember for the life of me what the name of it was, but it was about a kid who ends up hooking up with this guy who's got a time-traveling device that looks like a stopwatch or something like that called the Ankh. And
the show was called the Ankh?
No, the show was called Voyagers, I think.
And I remember that.
Yeah, and they would leap into a various part of time. And it was kind of like Quantum Leap because when they would jump there, there would be a time on it, and there would be a color on the left, which is red, and a color on the right, which was green. When they got there, the red light was on. That meant something had to be changed in order for them to be able to jump to the next time, and they very much, like Quantum Leap, had to leap home eventually. That's what they were hoping to do.
And so, when was this? Was this like a primetime show? Was this a Saturday morning show?
This was a primetime show. It was on, in the evenings, so to speak. And, yeah, I got hooked on it pretty much. And then after it went away, I totally kind of just, like, let it drift into the back of my head, thinking that it didn't really ever exist. And then I got on YouTube. Boom, everything is there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it was on 82 to 83. It was on one season. It starred John Eric Hexum.
And John Eric Hexum is...
He's this guy. I'm not sure. He's one of those guys that did a couple of things in the early 80s and then just completely vanished.
Is that a boy or a girl?
I believe they're both boys.
I can't tell. It's from across the room, and it was the 70s, I think, so I can't really... Yeah. Voyagers.
Yeah. And it's funny because...
Society of Time Travelers who did stuff.
Yeah, it starts off, the kid is living in this high-rise apartment. His parents are both, like, rich and, like, kind of ignore him for the most part. And this guy ends up leaping into his window, like, 43 stories up in the air. And he ends up taking the kid with him. Just like, oh, that's back in the day when you could do that. You could just disappear one night with a time-traveling dude in a Renaissance fair shirt. That's
everybody kind of went,
whatever.
I'll be back eventually. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Coming up later on, we've got your Peanuts watch still to get to, and we'll do the, I swear to Christ, we'll do the top five, top five songs used by me, Rick Emerson, to obtain show mode. It is, however, that time. Once again, will you please give your attention to Mr. Big Jim Willig for another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101.
Thank you very much, Rick Emerson. In the immortal words of Dr. Peter Venkman, it's always the quiet ones, comedy landscape volume is overwhelming at times. So much importance is put on being loud. Loud shirts, loud special effects, and over-the-top performances. It's very easy to miss the value in subtle humor. When I watched TV as a kid, the little things always caught my eye. One of the things I used to love to do was pretend to be the other person on the telephone. Like whenever Radar O'Reilly would call Sparky over at I-Corps, guess who took the call? Making up the other half of an ordinary conversation helped me to develop a sense of the fourth wall, and more importantly, when to break down that wall. Bob Newhart knew how to do this like few others. Actually, his comedy album from the button-down mind of Bob Newhart was even able to beat out the King, Elvis Presley, and the Von Trapp's The Sound of Music soundtrack, winning the 1960 Grammy of the Year. How's that for knocking you over with a feather? Alexander Graham Bell may have patented the telephone, but George Robert Newhart elevated it to a comic prop weapon on par with Whiskey on the Rocks or the Sledge-O-Matic 5000. H.P. Lovecraft knew the greatest monsters were those created in the imagination, just like Bob Newhart knew the best straight man was the one nobody else could hear. And with that, I turn the phone to the other two people in the studio with me at this time, my cousin Rick Emerson and my other cousin, Don Taylor. Your thoughts on Bob Newhart?
Don Taylor in the back.
Bob Newhart just recently, like this season, just did a guest shot on NCIS. As an old friend, as an old forensics guy who was like a buddy of their forensics fellow, who's played by David McCallum.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, Bob Newhart is, how old is he now?
He's got to be 80.
Yeah, he didn't become a father until he was 48.
He was born in 1929. So yeah, so he's like 81. And the thing is, he walked into like an episode of NCIS. And just stole every scene he was in from Mark Harmon, from David McCallum, because he is still just the master of timing. He can he can get more out of just a pause and a puzzled expression than anyone who has ever been in show business.
Yeah.
He's still a genius and always has been.
Couple that with the staggered timing. He very much is like, he's like a prize fighter you can't ever really get a punch in on, because of the fact that his delivery is just so unique, and it adapts to any situation that he's in. It just seems like, you know, he is an embodiment of comedy.
He's also the master of the stammer.
Yeah.
Of that thing we've talked about before, of engineering pauses and stammers into your line readings. And he... if he didn't invent it, he certainly did perfect it.
Well, he was the one who raised it to an art form, I think. Yeah. And you listen to him doing that, and you are right that it's, as much as it just sounds like he's a guy who just stammers when he talks, he obviously knows exactly, you know, it's like when you look at stagecraft, like there's, I was talking to our friend Siegfried about this, we were just nerding out about theater stuff and script writing and whatever. And he was talking about this thing called the Pinter pause, you know, and like Harold Pinter's scripts, where it's like, an ellipsis means this and a dash means that. And so it is with David Mamet, where like, a period means this and brackets, mean this when they're describing your action. And a double ellipsis means you're supposed to pause for exactly 4 seconds and all of that, because it's a science. I mean, it really is almost mathematical, the art of audience control and persuasion and manipulation, and the way that you speak to an audience and control the ebb and flow of the energy. And Newhart obviously does the same thing, where you listen to it and it sounds so effortless that it is easy to think that is just the natural cadence of the way he speaks. And it might be, but at the same time, he also understands exactly how to drop those in and where to put them and in what amounts, because it doesn't always work, and it doesn't always serve to set up the punchline, and it doesn't always serve to preserve the momentum of the piece if he is moving toward where the joke pays off.
Yeah.
I mean, again, Don just said that he may not be the first guy to do it, but when you talk about that kind of delivery, he's the guy everybody thinks of, because there has never been anybody better than that. I mean, in the 50 years since he started doing it, there's never been anybody better.
Yeah, that pause that you talk about, it really is immeasurable how short a time you can hold off before continuing on, where the audience will instantaneously lose interest or become distracted and therefore lose something, thus diminishing the amount of interest they have invested in what it is that you're trying to do. Bob Newhart, he could walk right up to the edge of that every single time and then just pull it back at just the right moment, so that it never looked like it was herky-jerky. It just looked like a very fluid motion.
When we finish the segment, normally we go to a break and we'll normally we play a song or something. When we finish this segment and go to a break, we'll actually play some of it, because as you noted, he doesn't really have punchlines. It's not like he has, two guys walk into a bar. The setup and the payoff are always elongated, and they're intertwined with, they're all 4 minutes long. So we'll play some of that when we wrap up. For people who maybe have not experienced his comedy records, they haven't, because he had The Button Down Mind of Bob Newhart, and then the follow-up was, it was like Button Down Rides Again or something. But he had a follow-up, I think, the next year that they put out, which was also, which my dad had and which I listened to growing up, which was fantastic. Because what I did not identify at the time, but what I now see, and if you only ever saw him on the Bob Newhart Show or on Newhart, you can see shades of this too. He is sort of, in some ways, a comedic... he's like a polar twin to Bill Murray in this way. The best Bill Murray performances to me, comedically speaking, are not the ones where he's like the brainiac running everything. It is the one where he is the sort of befuddled, sometimes confused, sometimes annoyed, irritated, everyman or normal guy who is witnessing or being subjected to or suffering at the hands of all of this idiotic insanity. And he is just sort of observing it all. And Bill Murray observes it with sort of a... sort of an aggression. There's a sort of an anger there because he realizes, you know, he actually is very sort of verbal about telling everybody else, like, God, you guys are idiots, you know, and he becomes very frustrated about it. Bob Newhart is sort of like that, but it's toned down. It's more of a, it almost has sort of a, it's almost sort of a Woody Allen meets Bill Murray delivery in that he is the lone person in the middle of this maelstrom who sees how out of control and insane the events around him are. And he's just doing his level best to remain calm and unflappable while dealing with this escalating series of inane insanities that are threatening to engulf him. And that is the persona of Bob Newhart. Everybody around him is crazy. He is the lone sane person trying to remain calm while talking to someone who is just flat out bonkers.
Well, the creation of both of his series were brilliantly done because they were built understanding exactly the kind of comedy he did. He was justly famous for his comedy records, his stand-up work, for his stuff, primarily where he was on the receiving end of a telephone call.
Right.
And you would hear just his side of a telephone call, that it was all very reactive. He is every man being put through something that is just untenable.
Right.
And we relate to that because we've, you know, all been there and have done that. When his first show, the Bob Newhart Show, put him in the position of being a psychologist. So as a job, there already you're going to have scenes where he is sitting there dealing with someone else who is crazy. He is going to be funny in the way he reacts to the other person. And then, of course, you know, he's going to be reacting to situations in his home life with his neighbor, with his wife, with the people he works with. When Bob in Newhart comes back, does another series, you know, now he's like a guy who owns an inn, and he is dealing with not only the crazy people who come and stay in his inn. He's a man who has moved from the big city to Vermont. And so, of course, now he also has to learn to get on with the crazy locals as well. Again, he's in a reactive situation,
and that,
which is what he is. He does so brilliantly.
And that stammer works perfectly in that context, too, because he really rolls it out when he has just been confronted by someone who is saying something just patently absurd or stupid or mind-boggling. And that stammer really works because it's the whole thing of like, okay, what you're saying doesn't make any sense, and so I'm trying to maybe help you see reason, you know, that you're ludicrous, you know. And it's that thing of like trying to wrap his mind around the fact that he's dealing with his boob, you know, whether it's Larry and Daryl or whether it's one of his nutcase patients on the Bob Newhart Show. And it's that whole thing of like, okay, I'm really trying to follow you and I'm trying to remain calm even though you are absolutely bonkers. And the thing is, he's permanently put upon, but not in a way that makes him sort of angry the way that Bill Murray's characters are, and not in a way that becomes, not in a way that can be off-putting over the long haul like Woody Allen's characters. Woody Allen has a variation on that same thing, where it's like he's the only smart person in the room and everybody else is inept and out to get him. Woody Allen can hit that one note a little too hard and a little too long, and it's like after a while you're just going like, okay, I get it. Newhart, though, is just perfect, because it's like the strange thing about Bob Newhart is his persona is always this guy who is dealing with some level of chaos or some problem, yet he himself is sort of a calming presence to listen to, even though he is dealing with escalating levels of trouble and strife. He himself is so unflappable that it's weird. Listening to Bob Newhart should be a stress-inducing experience, because so often, whether it's on the TV show or his comedy records, it's him, again, trying to make sense of the nonsensical, and yet you don't ever feel agitated, which it would be very easy to do. The strange thing about those records is how well those Newhart records were received in the 60s when they came out. Because what was it, like 62, 61, something like that, when The Button-Down Mind came out? How well they were received, and I mean, I'm not saying that people are smarter now than they were then. But, you know, let's be honest. You go back and you watch, you know, television then, or you listen to certain comedy, and things were a lot broader then. There was sometimes not a lot of nuance and subtlety. That was just, you know, art forms develop over time. And you go back and you realize that by all rights, I mean, in an era of, like, Take My Wife, Please, and, like, Milton Berle's hilarious because he put on a dress, Bob Newhart stuff was so cerebral it should not have worked.
Yeah.
At least not to the degree. I mean, goddamn, that's one of the best-selling comedy albums in the history of recorded music. I can see it being a cult classic or being an underground favorite. But I mean, he won Best New Artist at the Grammys with that record, which should not have happened.
And he beat Elvis.
Jesus.
I mean, that's not easy to do. And what's even more admirable, at least in my book, is the fact that all of his shows, he eventually put down himself.
Like, right.
This show has run its course. It will be canceled at the end of this season. This is not my attempt to kind of, you know, win some kind of attention so that next season I'll have viewers come back. He knew when to get off stage. He knew when it was done, and he never wanted to be the one caught out there after the curtain had gone down, being like, okay, now what do I kind of do? Why? And he's like, he doesn't want to have to do, he's like, we already did this premise last season. We're not doing it again. We're not going to rehash it in some way. Once it's done, the joke is done. Let us move on. If something else comes along, I'll figure it out. If not, then you know, let it be.
It's also interesting. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and he ended his second show with what TV Guide called the best finale of any TV series ever, in which it turned out that the entire series had just been a dream by his character from the first Bob Newhart show.
Finally, I had the craziest dream.
He wakes up in bed with Suzanne Pleshette and says that he just had the craziest dream.
Well, let's give it up for putting Suzanne Pleshette, who was hot as balls, on television during my youth. Thank you for that, Bob. And also,
he did it just for you.
Well, I'm just, it's like I got to Suzanne Pleshette, then later I got Julia Duffy. The other thing about the Bob Newhart show, and I don't know to what degree he had to fight for this, but I know it was not the way the network wanted it to go. I know he did really have to convince them to allow them to be a childless couple. Because you watch the Bob Newhart, and I think it's the same way on Newhart. But on the Bob Newhart show, you know, Bob and Emily don't have any kids. And that was not that common at the time.
And there was a discussion on the show between Bob and Emily, too, that I actually looked for that clip when I knew that we were going to be doing, because it's one of the best and most memorable scenes I remember from watching that show. And I couldn't actually find the sound clip. But there is an absolutely hilarious discussion that he and Emily have when they talk about how they have never had any children. And she says, well, perhaps they could adopt. And Bob Newhart does this weird little, like, couple of minutes monologue explaining in his stammering, low-key fashion about how, you know, when he was a kid, he would build model airplanes. And it was really great to build model airplanes and the great sense of satisfaction he would get when he would finish building the model airplane. And there was a store in town where you could actually buy the airplanes already made. And his father had offered to buy him one of these airplanes, but it wasn't the same thing. You know, it's like it's just more satisfying when you build it yourself from the kit. And the thing is, you know, I can't do it justice, but it was just pure Newhart and it was absolutely hilarious. At the same time, being kind of touching, actually.
Yeah. Well, and a thing that for that era especially was probably written in a depth that you didn't get on television sitcoms. So awesome. Well, we'll end this. Well, it's going to a break here and we'll actually play a clip of Bob Newhart. So this is around, I don't know, 3 minutes long or so. But and if people have only maybe witnessed him on television or they kind of know who he is, but they haven't really ever heard him, this is a perfect illustration of what he did. And it's also an illustration of what made him so different, especially now 50 years ago, where he wasn't just doing set up punchline. This is Bob Newhart, and this has been Humor Me 101 with Mr. Big Jim Willig. Find him online at bigjimwillig.com. That is bigjimwillig.com. We're back after this.
Oh, okay, all right, United 209. Yeah, we have radar contact. You're looking very good. Pan American 715. You haven't seen United 209 up there anywhere, have you? It's a big plane. It's one of those four-engine jobs. It's got United on the side. You can't miss it. Well, if you see him, would you tell him to call in? Yeah, 715, we're pretty jammed up here. I'm going to have to put you in the holding pattern. How's your visibility? Yeah, look off to your left about 3 miles over San Bernardino. Yeah, do you see all the planes? Yeah, just take a place anywhere there you can find some. we'll call you back as soon as we have an opening. No, don't call us. We'll call you. Okay, you guys on the ground, who wants to go up? Wait a minute, not all at once, guys. Which one of you guys has ever been up before? Which one of the two of you has an open runway in front of them? Branch 26. Okay, straight up, you pull up at the ocean, turn right again, and then straight ahead to Salt Lake City. Now, you can't miss it. It's got a big tabernacle. 715, I got to have an unidentified blip here. A blip? Yeah, listen, could you identify yourself? A Piper Cub. This is International Airport. We're sort of busy, you know. Why don't you try one of the local fields? Because your wife is meeting you here. Huh? Where are you exactly, Piper? The Texaco station at Hollywood and Western. Straight out the door and look to your right. You see the big hamburger sign? Yeah, take off over that. Now, you can't miss us. We're the first international airport on your right. Yeah, we'll leave the lights on. Don't worry. Miami 209. Yeah, you're a little off course. Could you speak a little slower? Who is this, anyway? Just a passenger. Huh? Could you let me speak to someone in charge? You are. Where's the pilot? How about the stewardess? They are. Huh? You ever landed a big plane like this before? No, it's easy. You just disengage your automatic pilot. It's a lever over your head to the right. Not all the way to the right. You already pulled it. I don't know how to tell you this. You just emptied the washrooms. Piper, could you hold on? I have an emergency call. Yeah, Pan Am, what is it? Yeah, that was 209 from Miami. He's a new boy. It won't happen again, I guarantee it. Right in the fan jet, huh? How about your wipers? Are they still working? Why don't you just tell the passengers it was a giant eagle? Okay, 209, I'm going to talk you down. You see the little Piper cub in front of you? Yeah, just follow the little fella on down. Yeah, Piper? Look, I don't want you to get excited, but as soon as you touch down, you keep moving, right? And promise me one thing. Don't look behind you, okay? Okay, guys, you can take it from here. I'm going on my lunch break.
Bye. You're listening to the Emerson News Network. You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. We're here with Mr. Big Jim Willig. And somebody asked if you have shows coming up in the Portland area anytime in the immediate future. Or are you going to be recuperating?
I'm still recuperating from the Eugene Salem back-to-backer.
Is it?
I've had this week.
Here's a question, and I think I know the answer to this, but you do like, I mean, how long is your set typically, like when you were just out on the road just now?
Did about like 15, 20 minutes, give or take.
So if you do that two or three nights in a row, I mean, does it wear you out? I mean, is it like draining to do comedy if it's not? Because people think of like a band going up and playing for 2 hours.
Yeah.
But if you're a comic, you're doing like 30 minutes. Like, is that exhausting?
It's more the travel. That's exhausting for the most part. Even if you have a hotel to stay in nearby, the space that you're staying, you still a lot of driving to get there. And then once you're done, what I used to do would be like get partied up, do a lot of drinking, and then the next day you'd wake up and you'd just be hungover, and then you had to do a lot of driving to either get home or get to the next gig. So either way, it's a very long and lonely time spent in between the sets. So there's a lot of lead up and then a little bit of time on stage. And then afterwards, a whole lot more downtime. So it is a lot of hurry up and wait mentality. So it is kind of exhausting, I feel.
Because, it's like your band said the same thing, that they spend, that you're on stage for 90 minutes, but it's like it takes you 9 hours to get to the gig.
Yeah.
And then there's like sound check and setup and whatever. And then it's like 9 hours after the gig driving to the next gig, all for like the 90 minutes or whatever. And the same thing, I think, probably with people who probably do like film or TV acting, it's probably the same way, where it's like you're just, waiting around, to do like your one scene or your five lines at a time before they get to stop and do a camera, change for everything else. So that is I would never be a comedian for any number of reasons. I don't have that skill for one thing. I'm just not that talented. But I also don't. I just don't have the intestinal fortitude for it. I think. I just don't think I could. I don't think I could deal with that. I don't think I could be a guy who just is on the road all the time doing that.
Well, what's funny is your audience is much more vast than your average comedian. The only difference is you don't have direct physical contact with them. There are some comics that when brought into a radio situation, they kind of lock up, which is hilarious because their audience is now reduced to like a handful of people. But they're used to doing it to at least, say, a dozen, two dozen, maybe a couple hundred people directly. That way you're getting that direct response. Radio, you're kind of doing it and putting it on faith that people out there listening are genuinely entertained. And when you have, much more thousands of people as opposed to a couple of hundred people that you do in a bar or a club or, a theater somewhere, you have a lot more plates to spin as opposed to your average comedian.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. That explains why comics so often when they come in, they do radio interviews, they just default to doing their shtick. And it's probably because they're unsure, and so they go to what they think, what has worked in the past.
Well, it's also you're in a room with a couple of strangers, and they're looking at you.
Yeah.
And the thing about being on stage, and you know this because you've done stage, is that I've always been fascinated by people who have stage fright. It's much more nerve-wracking for me to be in a room with a couple of people with three people I can see who are looking at me.
Yeah.
A crowd, a faceless crowd of people. It's like, I've never found that uncomfortable at all because it's like they are not individuals. They're the audience, And I think that becomes that way for people who do stand up and stuff all the time. It's like it's the audience. But you get into a small room with people who are going, hey, hi, OK, make with the funny now. And then it's like, then you lock up.
Laura and I used to have these arguments all the time about arguments, even the wrong way to put it. But I would just she would, take me to and she doesn't make me go out a lot or be social a lot because I just, she doesn't do very well there. But, she would have like her friends were like having like a barbecue and she'd say like, OK, like I don't ask you to do a lot. But like on Saturday, James and Janice are having a barbecue. So like you're going to go. And I'm like, fine. And it's like hours before the thing started, I would immediately just start to become like I'd get into jerk mode immediately and just become like really like angry about it and really like just and on the way I would just be like I'd just be all passive and snarky and and just mean about it. And so if we were on the way literally on the way to a barbecue at a friend's house one time and she finally pulled the car over and she's like, what is your effing problem? She's like, I never make you go anywhere. It's only like five people. Like, what is your problem? Like, why are you being such a dick about this? And actually, I had never put it together. It sort of came to me in a flash because, the thing about Laura is that she has she gets stage fright. If she and which many people do. You hear that thing. It's like the most common fear is speaking in front of an audience. It's not like she vomits or something, but she gets – if she has to do like, you know, like she has to do presentations for her job where she gets up in front of 70 people and she, you know, has to like, you know, here's what our department did this quarter. And she gets really nervous about it. And she can do it, but she has to really like rehearse it to the point that she memorizes it, because otherwise she'll, you know, get a little sweaty and freaky and whatever. And I said, you know, think about like, you know, when you have – I said, close your eyes and imagine yourself speaking to 70 people, 70 strangers. You're on stage in front of a big crowd. Like, what do you feel like? She's like, oh, that's terrifying. And I said, that's the thing. And it's exactly what you're saying. It is like an inverse proportion. The larger the crowd, the less nervous, like Dawn and probably you, Jim, the less nervous we are. But I told her, I'm like, the way that you feel when you're speaking to 100 people on stage or whatever, if you're after that, that is exactly how I feel in a room of 6 people that I have to talk to, like at a cocktail party or something. That is exactly the thing.
Yeah, when I went to this housewarming party that I talked about a couple of weeks ago, I was so keyed up for the long, and I just didn't want to do it. And I was dreading, and Patrick's going, you've been friends with him for a really long time. Was it, it's just the thing, and I have to make small talk, and I have to be nice, and I have to be friendly, and I don't know who's going to be there, and I don't know what they're going to want from me.
Whole weekend and if it's out there looming.
It was just like.
How far in advance did you know about it? Like, was it?
I knew about a week in advance, or I knew a couple of weeks that it was coming up.
And then as you get closer to
and
it,
I think
you're
there's
just,
this
you know,
part of me that kept thinking, oh, maybe there's some way I can get out of it. I think, you know, too. And as it was coming, I was like, oh, yeah, that's going to happen. And then I'd forget about it. It's like, don't remember, next Saturday. I was like, oh, God, yeah, okay. What? And then finally, when it was happening that day, I was just like, I was like a kid being forced to go to the DMV with their parents. I was like, I don't want to. Put your shoes on. No!
Don't take this the wrong way, but I am so glad you and I are not married. Because it would just be like... It would just be like we were checked into the Chelsea Hotel with just like a bag of China White. I mean, that's like...
No, you and I have done very well in that we have managed to marry people who are not like us.
Yes.
And so that way they can manage our particular crazy.
Does Patrick get is he like a social, like is he a performer in public when he's not a performer,
no.
But you know, like, and when he's in a room with people, does he sort of, you know, wah, 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 I'm a social guy?
No, he actually his thing is when he was a kid, he stuttered. And he's had his nose broken a number of times, so he has this way of speaking, like through his nose, that sounds kind of a little bit goofy. But he also has just some kind of a brain thing that I think it evidenced itself as a stutter when he was a kid. And his thing is, when he gets like excited or keyed up or wants really to impress someone or something, his brain starts spinning faster than he can speak, and so he becomes really kind of awkward. And sort of stumbles over himself. And it's hard for me because I know that he's just a blazingly intelligent guy. And between like the broken nose thing and the stumbling over his words, he will sound like such a doof. And it's more painful for me, actually, than it is for him, because I'm just standing there going, and I just want to grab him. He really is very, very smart. He's really
like,
way smarter than he sounds right now.
You want to sort
now.
Of like step in and be his proxy, just be his super Dave.
Because he's not nervous around people. He isn't afraid really of meeting new people or anything like that. But he will sometimes get – it's not as bad as it used to be when we first started – I first started like reviewing movies and doing stuff. He would get a little fanboy-y about meeting guys like David Walker and stuff, and be like, "Oh God, this David! I read Badass Movo. He's awesome." And then he'd go up to him and say, "I read this thing you wrote, and it was really great." And he starts stumbling over himself, and I'm going, "Oh, please don't be that guy. Please
stop,
don't
stop,
be that. Stop, 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 stop." And now, of course, you know he's known Dave Walker now for 10 years, and so it's fine. But in the beginning, or in the early, I was just like. Please don't.
It was really helpful of me, though, to put it in that to put in those terms for Lara. I'm just saying, like, you know, just imagine us as being polar twins. That is exactly the inverse ratio.
Yeah.
That the smaller the crowd, the more I feel what you feel in front of a large crowd, and that didn't solve the problem, obviously.
Yeah.
And she still does, like, only make me go to one out of every 5 social events because I still dread it. But I've tried to not be such a jackass about it, because I do at this point. What helped a lot is just understanding that she understood the deal, that she understood that I was, because I think she thought I was just trying to be a jerk. And I just told her, I said, I'm not trying to be a jerk. I said, I feel anxiety and apprehension. And so that just comes out as aggression.
Yeah, Pat still doesn't really understand it, because he knows I do this. He knows I've actually performed on stage. And he knows that I have that thing where I can I can be the person who owns the room. So he doesn't understand that I actually suffer from a crippling form of shyness when it comes to going into certain situations where I don't know a lot of people and I'm going to have to make small talk. And he still, even after 11 years of marriage, he still doesn't quite get why I get so keyed up and so scared and nervous.
And the thing is with you know, even with comics, I have the same thing. I have that same shyness about me as well, which is weird because you would assume, like, well, you're a comedian, we can throw you into any situation. And you're right. It's more like if being put into a situation where, yes, you can potentially handle it, doesn't mean that you're comfortable with it. And at the same time, you feel like, well, I'm the ham because you're putting me in here. I guess I got to, you know, make the monkey do the thing.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, by doing that, then, you know, you're just like, well, you're kind of pigeonholing yourself. And, you know, sometimes you just want to either get to know some people on a casual basis or just be left the F alone.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
Howard Stern, he said the greatest thing, one of his books, a phrase that I latched onto, he was talking about his wife taking him to parties and, you know, and him, again, the same thing of like, he just wants to be at home in front of the computer, you know, or like with the door bolted. And he said, oh, to not be the tall, gawky freak who has to make everyone laugh. we'll do the top five here in just a second. We should take just this moment right here to talk about Squires Electric. You can find them at squireselectric.com. It is squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. A longtime sponsor of the Rick Emerson Show. Well, first of all, longtime listeners of the Rick Emerson Show. They've been listening for like 13 years. And they have they've actually been here for about that time, and they've been sponsoring this show since very nearly since the day we came on the air here. So if you listen to the show and you say to yourself, I got your Don Taylor, you got your Jim Willig, you got your Bob Newhart observation, you got a top five coming up, and there's penis and there's taser and then wah wah wah, and it's only like
who could ask for anything more,
and it's only 32 cents, which is like, I keep saying you can't buy anything with 32 cents, and I guess you could, I just don't know what it is. It's nothing you'd want. I mean, that's the thing, like
put a good solid down payment on a stamp.
Can't mail a letter for 32 cents. I mean, really, there's nothing, not even, you know, most, like, I sound like an old guy, but like not even like your video game, your toy enjoy machine at the Safeway, these things no longer are these 32 cents.
Well, I thought about this last weekend when I went to Big Ass Sandwiches, and granted, you know, I make cookies for them, we have a relationship, they were really nice, that this particular time they did not make me pay for my sandwich, but I have paid for the sandwiches in the past. And the Big Ass Sandwich special, delightful, but it was also $9. And I realized, as I was carrying this, that's more than an entire month of our show.
Well done, Don Taylor. See, putting things in perspective like that.
You,
I mean,
you couldn't even buy an entire Big Ass Sandwich for the price of a month of our entertainment.
And really, we're offering pounds of entertainment a day. I mean, really, just, I mean,
with zero caloric intake.
Hectares of fat-free content and
if anything, the laughter that you extract from this show would be weight loss. I mean, that would be a win in your category. All you have to do is sit. You're losing weight sitting in a chair.
And that is all because of two things, the support of you, the Rick Emerson audience, the faithful who help to keep us on the air, and also our fine business partners such as Squires Electric. Contact them at 503-252-1609. And that has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business. They can make your life easier. That is SquiresElectric.com. SquiresElectric.com, licensed, bonded, and insured electrical contractors, installers, and supervisors. Hello, Don Taylor. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I just somehow managed to overlook that there was a wood chipper accident until just this moment.
Damn you! You failed everyone.
Cleaning the news.
I don't have my ribbons of shame soundbite. I got to find that. So forth. Well, so the next time you hear a wood chipper accident, which apparently won't be today, you can say to yourself, Squires Electric, as well as my fellow listeners, they help to make this possible for only 32 cents a day. So SquiresElectric.com or 503-252-1609. Would you like to read it now, or do you want to wait?
Sure. Well, it's very short,
okay.
So I could read it. Right,
I don't want
now.
To deny, because I know then you'll fix
I realize,
it.
I realize because it is timely because it was just today, in from Sydney, Australia. An arborist's legs have been severed after he got caught in a wood chipper in Sydney's northwest. The 29-year-old man was removing a tree from Cassandra Place at Carlingford when he tried to dislodge a tree stump that became caught in the chipper. Now, I guess the dislodging of the tree stump, I believe he was doing it incorrectly, as according to a statement, the worker's foot is believed to have become caught in the wood chipper, dragged him into the machine, and severed both legs at the knees.
Now, I'm trying to get a bit, so when you say he's severing, so there's a stump in the ground?
Well, he was trying to dislodge a tree stump that had become caught in the wood chipper.
Oh, I see. So he's feeding the whole. Okay, so it's not like he's taking out of it. Not like he's using the chipper to like whittle it down to the ground or so to grind it down. He's actually taken the whole tree out, and they're like, "Well, we got this chipper. Let's get rid of it now that it's out of the ground."
Right.
Oh my God, the stump is caught. Maybe I'll just kick it in with my foot.
Yeah, I'll just stick my foot in here and jam it in a little bit further. What could possibly go wrong? Ah!
In this gentleman's defense, though, I will say the safety stickers that usually exist on these kind of apparatuses are usually don't put your hand in this area. Nothing about the foot or the leg area is ever mentioned in the caution stickers.
Also, it's hard to read them when they're covered with dried blood.
Yeah, very true.
Right.
So there's that.
It's up there with don't whiz on the electric fence.
Here's the thing, and I don't mean to sound cruel, but if you need to be told that it's not just hands but the rest of your body that doesn't go into a wood chipper, there's, you know, you are someone who does not need to be diluting the gene pool down.
Well, the gentleman...
You don't get to walk anymore.
The gentleman is believed to have had 10 years experience as an arborist, but apparently could have used a few more tips on how to use the wood chipper.
God damn. You know, here's the thing about it. You know what we ought to do at some point? We ought to rent a wood chipper. And I know that sounds like the beginning of an awful, awful thing. But we should rent a wood chipper, maybe with somebody who knows, like a hardware store or some sort of, like a landscaping company. Have the guy like come out who operates it for us. Like we wouldn't be operating it. So like we have a guy bring a wood chipper out from some maintenance or landscaping company, and then we get like a massive list of non-horticultural but awesome items that could go into the wood chipper, and we spend all day chipping things.
I was not a big watcher of Malcolm in the Middle. I didn't watch a lot of it, but there was one episode of Malcolm in the Middle that I remember when the dad had to get a wood chipper for some reason, and at the end of the episode, he and the kids were entertaining themselves by just throwing random things into the wood chipper. And I will always remember just the joy of watching Bryan Cranston throwing like stuffed animals and golf balls and things into a wood chipper.
I saw that same episode, and the absolute best part of that whole sequence was, you know, he's throwing in like bikes and everything else that he can think of, and they show it going in and then getting shot out the other side, and he's like, he's pulling in thing after another, and then the last thing he throws in was a box of confetti. And it comes out the other end looking exactly the same, and his look of like, oh, well, that was kind of disappointing.
Great.
It was just priceless.
All right, I'm going to YouTube that tonight. But seriously, we should do that. We should just shred just a bunch of.
Yeah.
You know, like Letterman used to think of just like throwing stuff off a building or whatever.
Yeah.
Wood chipper, because that's the wood chipper is such a part of the show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really part of the it's part of the cultural content of this program.
Tasers and wood chippers are the two items of most mention here.
And we found out that tasing a watermelon like doesn't do anything, but shredding a watermelon in a wood chipper,
awesome.
Hey, we found a guy by way of a listener who works at one of those places. I mentioned that this to Don, and we were talking about paper shredders, and I said that they actually have automotive shredders at wrecking yards. Shredders, it's just what it sounds like. It's like the biggest paper shredder you've ever seen in your life, but you put like refrigerators and cars into it.
Dude.
We have a listener who works and runs one of those, and so we're seeing if we can go out there at some point.
Right on.
I'll
dude, done.
I'll let you know.
Please.
All right.
Before we move on to this, I just want to say, because I have been getting the Twitter updates from Charlie Sheen sent directly to my phone.
Of course.
And the last couple of minutes, he's been on a tear. This just in, he writes, another cosmic fastball from the mind of your fave warlock. Earn yourself. Then he creates a hashtag, earn yourself. Then follows that with, you already own you. Now go. Earn the power. Earn the truth. Earn the most important component in this entire dimension, yourself. And then follows that again with the hashtag, earn yourself.
Is this going to be one of those things where you see the billboard downtown where it's like an all-day leadership seminar with like Rudy Giuliani and Colin Powell and Bill Cosby and then Sheen like at the end? There's actually one of those.
We earn.
If you take the, if you're going over the I guess the Morrison Street Bridge or whatever, but it's the one that, I guess it's if you're going down Madison and then you come over and you're heading into downtown. And I don't know if you guys have ever gone to them, one of those, but it's one of those things where, like, your company will send you there.
Yeah.
And it's like...
I thought about going to those, but the prices are just so ridiculous because they know it's going to be, like, a write-off for your business.
Because you're not paying it. Yeah, the company's paying it. And so that's the thing. And it's like, you know, you go there at, like, 8 in the morning, and it's like you go till 5, and it's just like... If you're lucky, they're not... Like, sometimes you go there, and it's like you're being horked because it's like they'll say, like, appearing in person, and it'll be... And it always is, like, Colin Powell... Rudy Giuliani's one that they always have. There's like Donald Trump. But then you sometimes go and it's like they're just on a jumbotron from New York or something and you feel totally screwed. The one that's up now, though, you can see it if you go over the bridge when you get into downtown, and it says, and it just says the last name, it says Giuliani, and then Laura Bush. Giuliani.
Time permitting, Laura Bush.
you know, like Bush, Powell, and then. And like put into the corner, tilted at an angle, like all rakish, it just says Cosby in huge, which is weird. Like of all people, that Bill Cosby would be the headlining motivator there.
If I ever got the chance, I actually would really love to talk to Laura Bush. And I wouldn't really even want to talk to her about anything about her husband, although God knows I have so many questions. But what I'd want to talk to her about is apparently she, because she does actually come from Texas, unlike George.
Right.
And she has been, for decades, she's been friends with Kinky Friedman.
Oh, that's weird. I didn't know that.
And they both work together. He's worked with her on a charity. She has dealing with a dog rescue ranch in Texas.
How bizarre.
And he's, yeah, and they're friends. They've apparently been friends for decades. And he works with her raising money and doing stuff at this dog rescue ranch.
Kinky Friedman.
Yeah. How strange is that?
The man behind They Don't Make Jews Like Jesus Anymore.
And,
that's great.
And author of some actually very good detective novels.
In which he himself appears as a sort of like alternate version of himself, right?
Right.
I mean, it's Kinky Friedman's one of those guys that I know most of the stuff I know about Kinky Friedman because for the longest time he was one of the go-to guests on the Imus show. And I love the Imus show. And he was one of those guys that was just on like every day. It was like, Kinky Friedman will be in the studio. And it was like Kinky Friedman would just be there just being hilarious, just kind of being himself. I think that goes to the whole thing of politics just being theater, though. You know, it's like I was talking about how, you know, with Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch would like, you know, go yodeling together or whatever, like their barbershop quartet or whatever the hell they would do. I think that I think it is like a Morning Sam, Morning Ralph kind of a thing where they, the hound, you know, the where the you know, the sheepdog and the coyote kind of clock in and then they clock out. I mean, it must be. I mean, you know, because how can you take – I don't think politicians could take themselves that seriously all the time or they would just die. Your heart would just explode from – you know, like if Newt Gingrich was that agitated all the time.
That's why Cheney's heart is falling apart because he takes himself too seriously.
He's always on.
Right.
That's the problem. Here's your
he has one speed. Go!
He's more machine than man now.
He's on a drug called Dick Cheney.
Fire!
Counting is wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy, I love to count, don't you?
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We've been delaying this for like, I think this is originally for Tuesday, because you did yours on Monday.
I know, it's actually been so long, I've missed the song. It feels like it's been like a really long time.
It really has. Well, because every day we're like, I swear to God, we'll, you know. And then.
But I did
like,
mine on Monday. Just, this has been a long week.
It really has. Oh, speaking of which, so I promised just real quickly that I would tell you the story about the is it bourbon or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
The Maker's Mark.
Mm-hmm.
So last weekend we shot some footage for this promo that's going to get put together for the book. But part of that is there's a voiceover, and so Ashley, who is Jason Crump's gal, came in to do some of the voiceover for it. And you know, Siegfried was directing the voiceover session. And the big joke with Siegfried when he directs anything, well, two things. One is that he immediately escalates, like, to insane proportions, like, what he wants the scene to consist of. Like, I know somebody who worked in a 48-hour film project, the 48-hour film project with Siegfried, and, I mean, the 48-hour film project is just what it sounds like. I mean, it's like you have basically, I mean, really less than 48 hours, because it's going to be done and submitted, but you have basically 48 hours to write, shoot, edit, and complete a film, a short film. And I know somebody who worked on one of those with Siegfried, and like the second thing out of Siegfried's mouth was like, okay, now we got to get an airplane so we can do an aerial shot over the Grand Coulee Dam. And I mean, you know, and everybody else is just like, what can we film like in that phone booth over there across the street, you know, with like the $3 budget that we have? By the way, for that, lo and behold, he did get an airplane and they did get an aerial shot. So, I mean, he does sort of make that, but everything becomes Apocalypse Now to him. Like everything becomes a huge, huge production. Like, far beyond the scope of whatever you originally intended, which is cool, but it's just sort of, you know.
He is sort of magical.
Yeah.
He really is that guy that you know that leads some kind of a magical, strange life that is mysterious and different from anything that, you know, you yourself are actually doing
and
at
I,
any time.
I will say, too, that – and I don't mean to be this guy where I just sort of tease the thing, but he's very professional in the sense that, you know, he doesn't, you know, like doing it when he's, you know, on the show or whatever. Like, he doesn't, you know, tell tales out of school, as they
yeah.
say. But if you just, like, talk to him sort of off the air, just off the record, and just, you know, hear his stories from, like, working on film sets with – people of note.
Some of the things he just tosses off casually make you just do like this sort of whiplash you take with your head going, huh?
He has some of the most amazing stories. I mean, it really. But the other thing about Siegfried whenever he's directing is he just does take after take after take after take after take. But every time he just lies and he says, okay, one more for safety. And then like that, to the point that it sort of becomes a running joke. You know, and it's just because I think if you go like, okay, this is we're going to do take one. This will be one of 500. Everybody immediately, your energy is like, oh, I've got to do 500 takes of this. So his method is just to always go, that was really great. We probably got it. But, you know, for safety, one more. And then he'll just say that for like 4 hours. So yesterday he's here and he's directing us. He's doing the take. And he's like, one more for safety. No, that was great. One more. And at one point, I think he must just be armed like for all scenarios. So at one point he said, okay, we'll do one more. Ooh, and then I've got bourbon. And she immediately like perked up, and he just vanished to his car, and he came back up with that gallon and a half or whatever it is of Maker's Mark. And I guess at that point she had no problem doing another like 45 minutes worth of takes. So And then he left it here for reasons that are sort of unknown to me. Here is your top five for Friday. So on Monday you did the top five songs that you used to get into – and Jim's actually done this. You did the top five songs you used to get into performance mode.
Yeah.
Top five songs you get in the zone. Donna Monday did the top five songs that she uses to get into show mode, and then I was going to do my own. So here on Friday, right. it finally is. Don Taylor,
Our honorable mention is Social Distortion, California.
I got to hope I've actually brought the thing up. Yes, this is from Hard Times and Nursery Rhymes, which is the album that they just that I didn't even know was out until Ryan White had told us about it. This is honorable mention because it's a recent addition. This album only came out a few weeks ago. What a great record this is, though.
You said
the same. Yeah, that it.
Yeah.
It sounds like Social Distortion. There's no mistaking that voice or the guitar tone. But at the same time, it's not like they've just been making the same album over and over again. It really does sound. It doesn't sound like any of their other records. Except for those components of the band that are irreducible, such as his voice.
Well, if you go back to their... It's interesting, because if you go back and you listen to their early, early, early stuff, there was almost kind of this, like, you know, drunken Irish hooligan kind of a sound to it. And then they became, like, more and more kind of almost punk country western.
Right.
You know? And now they're just, like... indescribable. They are just Social Distortion. Nothing sounds like them.
And he and it is interesting if you listen to like Mommy's Little Monster or something like that, and then and then they became this sort of like weird Hank Williams in Hell kind of a thing where it was this very kind of I heard somebody, I think Katie Lang said she was talking about how much she loved them. She called them like cowpunk or something.
Yeah.
And that really is. But you listen to this record and it this is called, and again, if anybody's a Social Distortion fan or even if you ain't, it's called Hard Times and Nursery Rhymes, and it's really good.
Yeah.
And as much as, you know, as much as there is a sort of dark, you know, romance to, you know, the burnout before you fade away and Sid and Nancy and all that, you know, at a certain point, you pass a line, I think, when you're a musician or a rock star. I think if you haven't done that by the time you're 25, you got to just stick it out and stay alive, because there's nothing interesting or romantic about overdosing when you're 37.
When you listen to the lyrics of, like, the early Social Distortion songs... And you think to yourself, man, that Mike Ness, he's not going to make it to 30. But here he is, still kicking and making amazing music.
And he really does sound reinvigorated on this album. And he talks a lot about you know, because he was addicted to heroin for a long time. And he talks about being able to get back. And a lot of times, you know, when people clean up, then it's like they just, you know, they just lose the spark or whatever. But he really does sound like a guy who is appreciative of the fact that he's gotten a second chance. It's a great record, though. Also, I think for the very first time, I don't think I've ever heard this in a Social Distortion record, he does that thing that the rock stars all eventually figure out makes them sound even more awesome, which is to get the Sweet Black Soul Sisters behind him. Mm. These are the top five songs used by me, Rick Emerson, to obtain show mode. Don Taylor?
Number five, Oasis, Hello.
So this is the lead track off Yes.
Really?
Yeah, I did a myself.
Pleased to explain.
This doesn't like give me that sense of like, all right, let's go in there. It's fourth quarter. It's time to.
I am a big Oasis fan, first of all.
Okay. Admitting you have a problem is the first step. That's good.
I am a huge fan of Oasis, and this is. And I love this album. This isn't my favorite, maybe, but I do really love this album. This is off What's the Story, Morning Glory. Oasis is one of those sort of polarizing bands. Many people are not fans of Oasis. But this is not only a great song, it's the first song in the album. And I love bands that do great album openers and songs that do and songs that are great concert openers. You know, like when you hear a song sometimes, you can go like, oh, I bet this is the song they open the concert with. This in particular, is a really, really great song in that regard. It's a song called Hello, and it opens their second album, which is after they had become, like, the biggest thing on earth. And it's just a really great, loud, trashy-sounding song. It has that great, messy, pummeling guitar that I really, really love. And it is the way that this song... And I won't make you listen to the whole thing again, but if you listen to the very beginning, when they have this little guitar passage here, and that's actually that's from Wonderwall. That's the same thing that opens Wonderwall, and it's the same thing that opens Champagne Supernova, so it's a recurring theme throughout the record. And I love the fact that this song, it's short, it's like 2 minutes long, and they play the little Wonderwall riff, and then they go into the actual song. And so it is very much set up as an overture, which is why I think I like it so much. You had that. You had something face, as though you were about to observe.
No.
For me, Oasis, it isn't so much that I hate them with a fury or a power. I just think they're overrated for what they've kind of contributed for the most part.
I think that they were really, really mishandled in the sense that America was the problem with Oasis is that America was told before they'd ever come over here or really released anything that they were the best band in the world and they were better than the Beatles and they were the hugest thing ever. And so when you say that to Americans, especially when it's some foreign band, Americans are like, all right, tough guy, show me. And then, of course, they're not the greatest band in the history of the world, but they were marketed as that because of the way they had success in Britain.
And also we got, like, really, really soft, really poppy songs for singles and for radio play from them as well.
Yeah, I mean, that is also true, that the stuff they pick for Radio Airplane America is not the stuff that I would ever pick. But, it's that way with a lot of bands. Also, they're a-holes. I mean, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
They're obnoxious a-holes, and they're, as somebody said, they're drug-snorting, groupie-shagging, obnoxious louts. And I think people, like Americans in this case, will accept that if you're, like, a big rock star. But the problem is, that news reached us before the music did, and so everybody was like, well, they have no reason to be that, because I don't know any of their songs. Who were they to be such jackasses? And they had the biggest uphill struggle.
It's kind of the Amy Winehouse thing. It's like, we hear Amy Winehouse and go, wow, hey, she's really good. And 5 seconds later, we hear, oh my God, she's a big D-bag.
Right, exactly.
So... really have enough time to process that she was a great artist before we found out how horrible she was.
And then it's immediately the whole thing is just like viewed through that prism. Yeah. So these are the top five songs used by me, Rick Emerson, to obtain show mode. Don Taylor.
Number four, The Foo Fighters, All My Life.
And this is off. This is off The Color and the Shape. I don't even. I'm trying to think of the actual album this is off of. I don't think it's The Color and the Shape. It may be. Maybe In Your Honor. This song is great because it's a series of builds. It's a series of, like, build, release, build, release.
This is a great song.
It's a great song. By the way, it is staggering to me that somebody, and by somebody I mean Bobby Roberts, has not done a mix or a mash or whatever of this song with a song that we'll hear later on the countdown. And Grohl is such a master. I mean, as much as Kurt Cobain gets credit for writing great pop songs, Dave Grohl's part in that really doesn't ever get acknowledged to the extent that it should be. A huge part of what made, like, Nevermind such a great album is Dave Grohl. You listen to the acoustic guitar, it's Dave Grohl. You listen to every single harmony on Nevermind, that's Dave Grohl. Dave Grohl was the guy who gave that a lot of its pop sheen. And, like,
one by one hidden up my sleeve.
I mean, he, better than almost anybody writing contemporary, you know, whether you want to call it rock or hard rock or whatever, he knows how to do that sense of dynamic of the ebb and flow in a song.
Yeah. Do you think that Nirvana would have stayed together had Kurt lived?
No, I think that their record sales would have continued to trend downward. I mean, I know it's such a cliche to say that, you know, they're remembered so fondly because, you know, because Kurt Cobain killed himself. It's not like they hadn't impacted music beforehand.
Yeah.
But that, you know, the thing about it is, it's not like they're famous because he's dead. It's that because he died, they didn't get a chance to decline. That's really what it is. It's not
they
that, like,
burned out before they faded away.
Yeah, it's not like we're looking at that stuff as being better than we would or normally. It's just that he didn't get to live long enough to dilute his own legacy, which is what people typically do. You know, they have one great album, two great albums, two good albums, one okay album. Ooh, two good albums, one okay album, one bad album. He just didn't live long enough to dilute it down.
Yeah.
So I'm going to skip ahead to this this part toward the end. Where he reprises this sort of Deadstrom opening.
All my life I've been searching for something. Something never comes, never leads to nothing. Nothing satisfies, but I'm getting close. Closer to the prize at the end of the rope. All night long, I dream of the day. When it comes around and it's taken away.
He does a great, great rock and roll scream, too. There are few people right now recording that can scream like Dave Grohl. I mean, I don't even know how he can tour and do these songs every night and still have a voice.
Yeah.
Excellent. These are the top five songs used by me, Rick Emerson, to obtain show mode. Don Taylor.
Number three, Jay-Z, on to the next one.
And so,
Wait a minute. Also on to the next one.
That's what I'm saying. And so, especially because that Foo Fighters song just has such that an angular, squared-off rhythm to the way he delivers it. I am astounded that somebody has not mixed these two songs together. You're a fan of what's his name, the host of The Soup? What's his name? Joel McHale. Have you seen the video for this song?
No.
Oh my God. Oh my God, oh my God. Okay, Todd the Corpse hadn't seen it and he loves Joel McHale. So we were at my father's place and I was like, you know, oh my God, how about that Joel McHale and Jay-Z? And he's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh no. When you get a chance, you got to watch the video for "On to the Next One" by Jay-Z. First of all, it's a creepy, creepy video. It's like all of this black and white, like strange, like Illuminati imagery, and like all of this strange sort of like Masonic iconography. And then Joel McHale, no reason, black suit, and then wearing a grease painted like death's head, and then like. And not in like a funny, like, hey, I'm zany kind of a way, because you'd never know it was him, is the thing. He has this death's head painted onto his face in grease paint. And then it's just all of these creepy scenes of him, like, staring into the camera or walking toward the camera or the camera being on him and then it jittering back in place and going out of focus. And I didn't even know it was Joel McHale until I read an interview with Jay-Z talking about the video. I got a million ways to get it. This is a great song. This is off of Blueprint 3, which came out, I don't know, about 18 months or so ago. Which is a fantastic record anyway.
This is really good.
It's a great song. It's produced by this guy named Swiss Beats, who has done really some of the best record production the last like 5 or 10 years. Somebody bring me back some money, please.
throwback jersey, cause we on to the next one. Hit that auto tune, cause we on. Hit, don't be mad, cause it's all about progression. Loiterer should be arrested. I used to drink Cristal.
And it's got the cool, creepy, repetitive children's chorus in the background, which is great.
You won't have another drink, or you just gon' babysit. On to the next one. Somebody call a waitress. Baby, I'm a boss. I don't know what they do. I don't get drops. I drop the label. World can't hold me. Too much.
He later on in the song, as I think he does like seven times on this album, he references the fact that Obama texted him once.
Chilling on the big yacht. Yeah, I got on flip flops. White Louis bow shoes. Y'all should grow the fuck up. Come here, let me coach you. Hold up.
It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. These are the top five songs used by me, Rick Emerson, to obtain show mode. Don Taylor, what might number two be?
Number two, Frank Sinatra, I've Got the World on a String.
There we go.
Which is, I mean, come on. I mean, it's...
From the first note.
It's...
It's like I almost put the coffee song on my list. So.
I've got the world on a string.
Yes, you do.
Sitting on a rainbow.
This is off. This is from the Capitol Collection, which is sort of the place I go to for most of my Sinatra stuff. But if anybody really wants to start with Sinatra, because it can seem overwhelming, because he's one of those guys that put out like 700 albums. The Capitol Collection is a great place to start.
Yeah, the Capitol Years box set, where it's all the stuff he did with Nelson Riddle. And his collaboration with Nelson Riddle was the highlight of his career. That was the pinnacle.
I would also, if you want to just pick up something a little less expensive, if you want to get like a single record, I would also recommend Come Fly With Me. Come Fly With Me is a great record. Mm-hmm. If you want something more melancholy, In the Wee Small Hours. But I mean, you know, if you can find it, if you're out there shopping around, you want to pick something up, Capitol Years is a great collection.
Sitting on a rainbow, got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go.
It's just like so awesome, we don't even have anything to say, we're just listening.
I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow.
This is one of my go-to for karaoke. If I get enough in me, I'll give it a whirl.
Man, this is a lie.
I can't sing Sinatra karaoke because his key is just too low for me, sadly, so...
It's the key of cool. Like, it's just so casual. It's not monotone. It's just like, I can't even begin to put it into words. It's...
One of the best times all year for me, and I love Christmas, but and I love everything about Christmas, but it's when I feel that we are close enough to Christmas, which is of course the day after Thanksgiving, that I can break out a Jolly Christmas from Frank Sinatra.
Yes.
That to me is when Christmas has officially begun. It's when I can bust out my Sinatra Christmas record. That is as good as the year gets right there. The first time that I can put on my Sinatra Christmas records. These are the top five songs used by me, Rick Emerson, for show mode. Don Taylor.
Number one is Warren Zevon, Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
This is, I mean...
Well, yeah.
What are you going to say about that? I mean, it's... Come on. And, you know, it's interesting because this phrase, the whole, you know, send lawyers, guns, and money, there's actually a guy... This is true. There's a guy at... God, it was like at Yale or somebody. The professor at Yale. They referenced this in Zevon's biography. I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. There was a professor who actually teaches a course called Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and it was about. And he uses as your entry point this song, and he makes the case that Warren Zevon has summed up in this song the three things that are necessary for any government, any society, any faction, any group to obtain or hold power. And so this is the theme that is shot through, and it's like a serious course, but the overarching theme is lawyers, guns, and money. It's like that series on PBS, Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Yeah.
And he teaches this course called Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and his whole point is that this is the trifecta of things that will allow anything to be obtained. But you cannot obtain things in a global sense or in a political sense without Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Somehow I got stuck.
Also, when I saw that that Johnny Depp, Hunter S. Thompson documentary, Gonzo, a couple years back, I had no idea that this was the case, but I have always felt like this song reminded me of Hunter Thompson.
Oh, yeah.
Always, and when they went to the closing credits and this song just started playing, I mean, it was the most perfect thing ever.
Speaking of Hunter S. Thompson and Johnny Depp, by the way, I do want to mention before the end of the show, go see Rango this weekend.
I'm going to see that with Laura tomorrow.
If you are listening to the sound of my voice right now, go see Rango this weekend.
That's Is it 3D?
No, it's not. On top of everything else, it is in glorious, gorgeous, not dim, not annoying, two-dimensional movies.
Awesome. Well, Steve, I like that because that's so much. Then it makes it even more impressive that you raved about it.
Yeah. No, it is. It is great.
All right. Send lawyers, guns, and money.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We want to thank our guests, including Mr. Big Jim Willig. Find him online.
Totally welcome.
BigJimWillig.com. If I finally, at long last, gotten that correct, is it BigJimWillig.com?
It is. Next week, I'm gonna move. I'm gonna just change it. I'm an enigma.
Thanks so much.
Never to be found. Never to be cornered.
You should go home and sleep.
Really?
Yeah. It's not like you don't sound great. You sound great, but I look at you now and again, and you've got that look behind your eyes.
Honestly, it's got a lot to do with sobriety. I just I'm having a hard time having fun. But everything's kind of like falling into the sense of meh. It's weird.
Thanks for ending the show on an up, Jim. I appreciate
all right,
that.
I mean, yeah. Hell yeah. BigJimWillig.com. Go check me out, baby.
Winning. See, there you go.
I've got the blood of a warlock.
That's what
cheetah.
I'm talking about.
That's high on Charlie Sheen.
Imagine how great it would be just to someday when he shuffles up his mortal coil just to snort that guy.
Yeah.
The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekdays for the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milk Packing District in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon, at the news desk, Don Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. Don't forget Outlook Portland this Sunday, 6:30 on cable channel 3. That is on Portland's CW Northwest 32 TV. Also, later on the day, we'll have a little blog entry about the Sleep Country Pajama Bowl and that team, and then we'll be talking to them next week as well. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. The Rick Emerson Show is made possible by a generous grant from y'all. It is Friday, March 4th, 2011, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, thank y'all for listening. Be safe. See you Monday. Bye now.